Everybody, we are live.
Gentlemen, I have excellent news.
Oh?
We have not one, but two new anniversaries to celebrate. I am not even kidding.
What now?
I am so excited.
I saw that in the email. Now I've decoded the notes here. I think I replied to that and shamed him for having another anniversary. But
of course, Casey. You did. All right. Well, actually, so the first one is for a Mr. Let me check my notes. John Siracusa. Who a year ago, tomorrow as we record this, but by the time you hear this, a year ago today, in all likelihood, had announced that he was going independent. So, John.
Oh, yeah.
How's the last year been?
I could swear I put that in my calendar to remind myself to talk about it. Are you off by the day or something?
No, it's hypercritical.co/2022/03/30/independence-day. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, we don't need to belabor this, but how's the last year been, bud?
That's fine. I mean, I thought I put something in my calendar to say, hey, it's been a year or whatever. But really, realistically, setting aside that thing I probably put in my calendar like a year ago, the main thing I'm thinking about is that 2023 will be the first full year. And this is in front of my mind because we're doing like tax stuff now. It will be my first full year without jobby job income. So, like, I feel like it just doesn't count because last year was like I had a jobby job and then I didn't. This year, and you know, if everything works out, then we know jobby job income. And so this will be the first full year. So it'll give you an excuse to have another anniversary, which is basically next year around tax time. You can ask me, what was it like having an entire year without a jobby job? And I'm going to say, well, with the podcast ad market the way it is, it was pretty rough. But anyway,
right? I was going to say, you picked a hell of a year.
It's like, well, you know,
the worst ads we've seen in years.
It's kind of like when I When my son was born, my first child, my oldest was born, and then I got laid off like a week later. So that's just
did I know that? I don't know
the way
I
roll. It was when the ebook company got bought out, and they said, "Hey, everybody, you could either pick up your family and move to like North Carolina or whatever, or you're all out of a job tomorrow. Let us know. You get 24 hours."
Nice. And we all know you wouldn't set foot anywhere south of Long Island.
Oh,
so.
If it was a job that I love for people that I thought were, you know, the people who bought the company, if I didn't think they were a bunch of tools, I might have considered moving. But no, they were terrible people and none of us like them. And we all just left. Alex, I remember bringing Alex to the office in his little like infant carrier thingy or whatever. And yeah. So anyway, here I am. I'm still hanging in there. ATP.fm/join.
Yes, please. We're going to talk about that more in a minute, but I am glad that you're still hanging in and congratulations, all snark aside, congratulations on a year of independence. You've made it at least one, so that's a good start. And then we alluded to this moments ago, but it was brought to our attention via email that we have another anniversary to celebrate, which is the 10-year anniversary of friend of the show, Jonathan Mann's ATP ending theme. I almost said theme song, but it was actually entitled on YouTube, ATP ending theme. And so it was released 10 years ago, a couple of days back. What was it, the 26th of March, 2023? And we started using it every day. I don't know, Marco, what was it, like the 27th, basically?
Yeah, it was pretty like, soon afterwards. Yeah.
So thank you to Jonathan Mann.
Please check out all
of his work.
That song, like I remember we were talking at the time, we were talking to Merlin Mann just casually, like, hey, are you interested in maybe writing us a theme
song?
Yeah,
I forgot about that.
And then Jonathan wrote this song, you know, unbeknownst to us. He kind of came out of nowhere with this song. And I remember, like, I forget exactly the timeline of it, but the gist of it was, after some brief amount of time, this song was still in our heads. And it was so much in our heads. And I'm like, first of all, I like this song a lot, and it stuck in my head. Second of all, if I like it and it stuck in my head, other people will probably like it as well, and it'll probably stick in their heads, and that's probably good for our podcast. So we basically went to Merlin, like, you know what? Since you haven't started yet, never mind. We got something else. Thanks. Sorry. And we started putting this song in every show, and it's fantastic. I love the song so much, and just so thankful to Jonathan for writing it and letting us use it all this time.
And then Merlin did do the theme song for Reconcilable Differences, so he got to do a podcast theme.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true. There you go. So, we'll have some links in the show notes to Jonathan's stuff, to the actual YouTube video, to John's announcement post, and the ATP wherein we discussed all this. And it was one of my favorite, bar none, one of my favorite moments of ATP when John just dropped this on us. And I certainly had no idea. And I think, Marco, you also had no idea. Is that correct?
What were your guesses? Like, I made you guess. What
were
your guesses?
Terrible. It was truly terrible. I know what you're thinking of, and I can't remember what we guessed. I think Marco was closer, but both of us were pretty far off. I don't remember. That's all right. Well, anyway, so congratulations. More anniversaries to come. I just got to figure out what excuse I can come up with to figure some out. But maybe we'll let the occasion inflation rest for now. All right. We also need to talk about, speaking of ATP members and ATP.fm/join, we have recorded another ATP member special. John, would you like to tell us about it?
We talked a lot about it on the actual episode, so I won't go too far into it, but it's another ATP Movie Club episode. This time I picked the movie, but I picked it kind of at the request of Marco and Casey, because they expected me to make them watch a Studio Ghibli movie or something, or The Godfather or something like that, and I didn't. I made them watch Edge of Tomorrow. And so they said, well, you know, what if we do that? What if you pick out a Studio Ghibli movie for us to watch? And then I had a big debate about which one I was going to pick, which I talk about on the show. I ended up picking My Neighbor Totoro, which is kind of straight up the middle for a first Studio Ghibli movie. But it's not straight up the middle when the people watching it for the first time are Marco and Casey. So if you are an ATP member, please check out this episode. It may not be exactly what you expect, but I think we delve into the movie in a way that you probably haven't heard before, because the other two people on the show are first timers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yep. I think it was quite interesting.
it was something. So please feel free to check that out. ATP.fm/join. You can join for a month. You can join for a year. you can join for a month just to get this one episode, and then forget to cancel. Whoopsie doopsies, no problem there. So you know, do what you got to do. But we encourage you, especially in this genuinely trying time when it comes to podcast advertising, it would be lovely if you had a few bucks to send our way. You know, we would appreciate it, and we try to do good stuff for you. I don't want to make any promises about future HP member episodes. We do intend to do them, you know, maybe once every month or two is our goal. It doesn't mean we'll succeed. That's the goal. We've been kicking around some other ideas that are not Movie Club. I'm sure we will return to the Movie Club well, but we are trying to be inventive and creative, even though that's not necessarily in our wheelhouse. So we will actually be talking a little bit more about this probably in the post show. But anyways, hp.fm/join. You can join us in watching or discussing at least My Neighbor Totoro.
And keep in mind that if you join up, even if you're just joining up to hear this one episode, like if it's a monthly membership at minimum, you can listen to all of the member special episodes in that time. There's only like, what, 4 or 5 of them at this point. So you're not that far behind, and you'd be getting your money's worth even if you just pay for 1 month.
Yeah, you have access to everything that we've ever done as a member, anything. The full feed, like, you know, it isn't just from the time you sign up forward. You have access to everything that we've done in the past. So, yeah, feel free, help yourself, and then just, yeah, kind of forget to cancel. You'd be shocked how bad the podcast ad market has been so far this year. So, you know, we're fine. Don't worry about us. But if you've been on the fence about becoming a member, this is the great time to do it.
Yeah, selfishly, it would be lovely. There are 6 episodes. There are 5 Movie Club episodes, the original trilogy, if you will, and then the Oopsie Doopsie, we never watched Hunt for October, and Oopsie Doopsie, we never watched a Ghibli movie, and then the Frozen Dinner Fiasco, which we may never live down. So there's plenty of good stuff for you to check out if you're interested. Moving on, let's do some follow-up. And John, there's maybe good news, maybe not, about HDMI quick media switching in action on an Apple TV 4K. Tell me about this, please.
I think we talked about it when the new Apple TV 4K came out and had support for this. And we discussed the technology involved a little bit. And then the capper was, unfortunately, no televisions support this feature. So you've got it on your Apple TV box, but it's pointless. Well, now it's 2023. The 2023 crop of televisions have come out, and several of them do support quick media switching. What this is supposed to do for you is make it so that when the television switches something about the picture it displays, it switches from 1080 to 4K, it switches from, you know, 60 frames per second to 24, it switches from SDR to HDR. If it does any of those things, most modern televisions will black out the screen, kind of like it's an old, you know, CRT or something, make it go all black, and then waits a couple seconds, maybe a couple 3, a couple 4 seconds. And then it will come back on with whatever the new settings are. This is relevant because if you use my recommended settings on the Apple TV that tell you to match frame rate and match, what is it called? Match dynamic range or whatever. That means anytime you switch between one mode and another, you will get that black screen. And that happens surprisingly often because probably when you're using the Apple TV initially, you're just on the menu and you're going through the menus and you can pick what you want the menus to be displayed in, you know, like the little grid of all the icons, all your different apps on your Apple TV. You can pick if you want that to be in 1080 and 4K and SDR and HDR, right? But it doesn't matter what you pick, because chances are good that when you launch an app and start watching something in the app, it will be different than what you picked. Because I think your only choice, well, I guess it's not your only choice, but the default choice that most people do, for example, is 60 frames per second for the thing where you see the apps and stuff. Like, why would you put that in 24 frames per second? That would be weird. But you know, again, no matter what you pick, if you watch a TV show, that's probably not going to be 24 frames per second. If you watch a movie, it probably will be 24 frames per second. Is the show you're watching HDR? Is the show you're watching SDR? There's going to be a mode switch somewhere in your future. And that induces a black screen and a couple seconds of wait. And that is annoying. And the reason I recommend that having that feature on, even though that, you know, black screen is annoying, is because to do otherwise would be to pick a mode and, you know, dynamic range thing and just watch everything in that. So you say 60 frames per second HDR, everything's going to be like that. Well, everything's not 60 frames per second HDR. And if you ask your television or your Apple TV to convert everything to 60 frames per second HDR, it'll do it and it will look awful, right? No matter what you pick 24 SDR, pick, like, it's going to be incorrect for some show. So you do want it to switch, but you don't want to wait. Quick media switching was, in theory, some part of the HDMI spec that was supposed to help with this. But as we said last time we discussed it, The only thing it helps with is when you change frame rate. That's it. So if you change any other aspect of the thing, if you change from 1080 to 4K or back, if you change from SDR to HDR, you still get a black screen. So I was kind of disappointed in that standard, but it was like, well, let's wait to see it comes out if it, when it comes out on TV, what it's like. So now it's out in a TV. We'll put a link in the show notes to a YouTube video so you can see it in action with an Apple TV 4K on a new 2023 LG television. And when you switch only resolution, no black screen. Thumbs up. You know, it still does like a crossfade or whatever, but at least the screen doesn't go completely black and you have to wait, right? When you do anything else, black screen. But, and I don't understand this, but you can see the results in the video for yourself. If you have quick media switching enabled on this particular LG television and it goes to the black screen to switch modes, the black screen is up for less time than if you don't have quick media switching on. That makes no sense to me because it's like, if you change something other than, frame rate, quick media switching shouldn't be involved. And yet it is. So you can see the results. It also puts up this LG television puts up a big gray banner that says quick media switching or something. It's like, man, it defeats the purpose. I don't need to see a banner. Just do it. Don't. Anyway, so the struggle continues for actual timely, fast switching. And I guess we kind of just got that with the ARM-based Macs. Remember we were talking about when the M1 Max first came out, how quickly they changed resolution? And how we were used to the idea that on the Intel Macs, of course, your screen's going to blank out for a second. And when they didn't do that and it was like instant, it was like, wow, this is great. We're still waiting for the day that TVs do that. But in the meantime, it seems like quick media switching is a slight, very slight upgrade from not having it. So you happen to have a fancy new Apple TV 4K. You happen to be in the market to buy a new television in 2023. I guess look for one with quick media switching and then just wait with the rest of us for the next 5 to 10 years when HDMI standards catch up with what we want them to do.
Yeah, we'll see what happens. But I was, like you said, I was super disappointed that it was only for, what was it, frame rate you said? One it was. And everything else, it was the exact same thing that we...
But not the exact same. It's faster black screen. Wow. That's what's so weird. It's
fair.
All right. You know, and the other thing, the reason it's only frame rate is because it's built on VRR, variable refresh rate. Which is a feature of HDMI where it's mostly for gaming. Like when you're playing a game, instead of having the game demanding that the game produce 60 frames every second, you can, and refreshing the screen at 60 frames per second. Instead you can, the television or the screen or whatever says to the game, just give me a frame when it's ready. Right. You know, if you don't have a frame ready when you're supposed to, don't worry. I won't refresh the screen. I'll just wait for you to give me the frame. That's variable refresh rate. So, since they already had that feature implemented, it's many, many years old feature. They already had that implemented. You can think of changing from 24 frames per second to 60 as a weird kind of variable refresh rate where it's like 24, 20, 20, 24, and then 60. And so the hardware and software to do that was already kind of built in so they could build this on top of it, which basically makes quick media switching. It's like they didn't really do any work. They're like, well, we've already got VRR. Can we just do something with that? Sure, we'll call it quick media switching. It's basically VRR, but for your television. Anyway, disappointing, but you know, it's HDMI. What do you expect?
And then, John, you have all sorts of new figurative and potentially literal tools in your tool chest with regard to destroying and recreating your own custom furniture.
Yeah, my little story about cutting some threaded rod to shrink some furniture that I bought resonated with a lot of people. The most common suggestion I got was a better place to buy threaded rod and other things. I bought mine from like Grainger.com or something. Everybody recommended McMaster-Car. It's McMaster.com, McMaster.com. They sell stuff like that, threaded rod, fasteners or whatever. Very popular company. Everybody who wrote in about them loves them, says this is where you should get this stuff. I did look and they did have threaded rod. The price was similar to what I paid. They didn't have stainless steel though, which is kind of what I preferred as opposed to like zinc coated whatever. But anyway, that's a website people recommended. Sean Cameron was one of many people to recommend tool lending services. Everybody said this was well expressed. As a fellow technologist who is tool inclined and having a lot of the same predilections as John about how things should be around the house, I also find myself holding back on buying all sorts of tools, including vices, as in things that squish things. I wanted to mention that many communities have either workshop spaces or tool lending libraries through which you can get access to specific tools for a specific job. This is a much better approach than spending money on your own version of a tool that you only need once or twice. And then, what's this? CC Helberg tooted to say, I couldn't find one near you, but tool lending libraries are a thing for both woodworking and more, and also for things like specialized shaped baking dishes or even fly fishing kits. I've seen everything from apparel tools, drill bits, ladders, garden tools, and even a cement mixer in them. And the website, which we'll link in the show notes, is localtools.org/find. Many people sent me this URL while also noting that they could not find any near me. So I guess it's not, you know, it's not everywhere, but check around you. It may be nearby. That would be a good idea if I cared a lot more about cutting some threaded rod. You know, again, I got the job done. It would have taken me more than a day to find this place, drive to it and see if they had something for me and then return it and blah, blah, blah. So probably not appropriate for what I was doing, but very handy for other things. And it does save you from having to buy a tool. And finally, lots of people suggested something that I already knew about, but did not employ, which is when cutting, cutting a threaded rod and you don't want to screw up the threads with your hacksaw or whatever. One trick is to thread one or two nuts onto the threaded rod, either having two nuts, tightened against each other or two nuts with a gap between them so that you're basically protecting the threaded rod with a metal thing that is, you know, fixed in place. And also after you finish cutting through it with your hacksaw pressed against one of the nuts, then you back the nut off of the threaded rod and that will, you know, smooth out any burrs that are on the threaded rod, you know, to get it, you know, to get it so the thing goes on and off. All good ideas. I did not have any nuts to put on the threaded rod. And they're like, oh, you can just buy one of those at McMaster. Yeah, I could have, but now I'm ordering another thing, waiting for it to come, or I'm going to another home store and looking for an M6 1.0 nut and buying a bag of them for $5 and that I'm never going to use again, and yada, yada, yada. Anyway, I cut it by hand and I survived. So thank you for the suggestions. But if you had to cut more than one piece of threaded rod, get a vise. Get a vise, get some nuts to fit on it, get a hacksaw, get a new hacksaw blade. I guess don't do what I did.
Only on this show do we have threaded rod follow-up.
Yeah. Indeed.
And everybody wanted me to buy a hacksaw blade. Like, oh, buy a hacksaw blade. They're $2. Oh, they're $6. You know, they're not $2, but yeah. Because wow. I didn't look up, like, really? Your hacksaw blades?
We can't buy hacksaw blades $2.
Right?
Yeah, no, they're not. Yeah, you can buy a new one. All that. I should probably get a new one, but, you know, again, I was at just the home store for threaded rod. I didn't think to look for hacksaw blades, and then you got to take the old one off and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, next time I need to use my hacksaw, I will definitely do it. But truthfully, I thought the hacksaw blade was not as in rough shape as it was because, like, how often do I use it? But I had forgotten that this hacksaw was, like, from my father-in-law's tool collection, so it had seen a lot of use before it even got to me, and I was under the impression that it was actually a newish hacksaw with a newish blade, and I was wrong.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we have that resolved. Josh Calvetti writes, with regard to camera apps, as in, you know, for physical cameras and geotagging and things, Josh writes, when I was shooting Sony about a year ago, I was using Camrote, I'm assuming that's like camera mode or something, anyway, for geotagging and control of my A6600, much more user-friendly and stable than the official Sony app, and it doesn't require you to sign up for anything, and that's camrote.app on the web. We'll put a link in the show notes.
Yeah, there's a lot of third-party apps, because we were complaining about first-party apps, like the apps from Fuji or Sony or whatever, how terrible they are. There are actually a lot of third-party apps that will work with various brands of camera, and as you would imagine, they're all, you know, much, much better than the first-party ones. I actually did try this Camrote thing. I don't have occasion to use my big camera in geotagging. Like, I'm just using it around the house. I guess I could still geotag those, but I can geotag those manually, too, because I'm literally in my house. but next time I go, you know, on my next outing, I'm definitely going to use that, because I said before, I can't actually sync both of my Sony cameras with my phone because the stupid Sony app only lets you sync one camera at a time. So I will try the third-party one, and we'll see how it goes.
Good deal. And then speaking of cameras, but this time ones within phones, apparently the Samsung fun hasn't ended yet. You can opt into, so this is different than the Moon discussion we had a couple of weeks back. The Moon thing was happening just kind of automatically, but you can also opt into quote unquote remastering photos. And according to one person, and as per in The Verge picked this up, and they said that they weren't able to recreate it themselves. But nevertheless, according to this one person, they took pictures of their baby and then tried this remaster thing. And this very gummy baby suddenly had teeth because the remaster thing kind of just thought, oh, that human should have teeth there. And it's it's a little creepy. I think it's not as a dramatic problem or difference, perhaps is a better word for it, as the whole moon thing, but it's definitely a little weird and kind of funny. So there's a link in the show notes to The Verge that covers all this. It has some GIFs that you can look at. It's something else.
I think the moon feature is on by default. I'm not sure if that's this right. one is, I believe but this that's is right. definitely the type of thing where if you didn't notice it and then went back years later, especially if it like burns it into your picture, you know, like if you can't go back to the original as mm-hmm. captured by the camera or whatever, you're like, how does this, you know, 3 week old baby have teeth? It's like the magic of Samsung. You skipped an item, by the way, Casey.
Did I? I'm sorry. Yes, I did. All right. Hi, future Marco.
The order is not important.
No, I'm sorry. I did not even see that. I am a professional. hp.fm/join. All right. Got to lock it up because I'm a professional.
Only the people who are already members hear that. What are you telling me?
I know. That's true. Actually, that's a good point. I didn't think about that. Super professional around here. All right. And then we have some information. Did we cover the True Siri experience? I didn't think we covered this on the show. Did we?
Yeah, that was the title of the last episode, and we covered this exact thing. I couldn't remember the details, but then I revisited it or whatever. It was the person asking Siri for the weather. They just got a HomePod, and they said, yeah. I just tried to ask it the weather, and all it said was, done.
Yeah, we did that. All right. Yeah.
Okay, my mistake. So anyway, so with regard to that, Benjamin Mayo wrote and had a really good point. Benjamin wrote, Siri having just said done implies that it's running a shortcut. Do you happen to have a Siri shortcut in your library? Benjamin was talking to the person who originally posted this. Do you happen to have a shortcut in your library that has a name similar to weather? It might be getting confused and running the shortcut instead of actually looking up the weather. And the original poster, Nairobi, wrote back and said, I sure did. I had two that seemed to have no real purpose. I deleted them and Siri seems to be able to answer me now, consistently even, which is good news. So as much as I love crapping on Siri, turns out this one was a legitimate oops.
But that's a situation where you're like, yeah, there is a problem, but how would anyone figure that out? You know, like you know that you're able to ask the HomePod what the weather is. You do that and it does something different. Like, what's your next debugging step? Are you going to know that you have some random shortcut that happens to have, you know, it's called check the weather or something because you clicked on some link that you forgot about a year ago? It's the debuggability of voice assistant, the discoverability we talked about before of like, what can I actually say to you is not great. And then when something goes wrong, like, what do you do to figure out what the problem is? Because there's, you know, the interface is talking. And, you know, if it doesn't understand what's the weather, the idea is that it's going to understand you conversing to it about what went wrong is, you know, probably not particularly likely. Although this next item has more on that topic.
Indeed. So somebody put together basically ChatGPT inside an iOS shortcut, which is kind of bananas. And there's a really interesting, unfortunately it's on Medium, but there's a really interesting post about this. And there's a video included as well. It is fascinating. And from the way the video was edited, and I think there was a little bit of complimentary or aggressive editing on this video, I think, but nevertheless, the way the video is edited, it is darn impressive. So the person whose name I don't have in front of me wrote, I explained everything in plain English. Oh, I'm sorry. So this is with regard to how did they hang all this together? And so apparently what this person wanted to do was have ChatGPT basically interpret their verbal commands and turn it into a JSON, you know, payload that could be sent on to other things. And so how did they convince ChatGPT to do this? Well, they literally explained it to them. So now quoting from this post, I explained everything in plain English. I described the types of requests, the exact structure of the response, and asked it to behave like a sentient AI, giving advice even for personal questions. I also provided a few details about time, location, and the devices in rooms in the house. From this, we will receive a perfectly structured message. And that's all. That's all there is to programming it. So there was no, you know, direct specification of here's an example JSON. It was just build a JSON object that has, you know, keys and values and so on and so forth. It's nuts. So there's an example here, command. Quote, I sent my son to bed to read for another 20 minutes. Can you switch off the lights in his room when it's time to sleep? And sure enough, this works. And so in this case, GPT-3 understood that it is probably the bedroom that needs switching off. And it added the correct timestamp, which is 20 minutes after the time we passed the request. And you can see a little sample JSON there. All of this done without actually writing any code, at least on the ChatGPT side. And then I guess the other end of this was like some bananas, crazy, just in bananas complex shortcut, iOS shortcut that processes this JSON and takes action on it.
I think it's like sending it to Home Assistant or something. Like, so this is the reason I put this in here, is, and the reason everyone was sending this to me is because it's exactly what I described in the last episode when I talked about like what could, you know, how useful is ChatGPT to making Siri better, essentially. And I said, well, you know, one thing you could do with it is have it interpret what the person is saying and then translate it to the very, very limited and rigid structured vocabulary of Siri, because that seems to be the stumbling point. Like, you have to phrase things in a certain way for them to work with Siri. We talked about this with, like, you know, adding new words, taking 6 weeks to rebuild the database and everything. Siri can understand all sorts of things that you say, but every single one of those had to be thought of and explicitly put into Siri by a person. You know, the number of variations are not infinite. You could never say something to Siri like, hey, dingus, I sent my son to bed to read for 20 minutes. Can you switch off the lights in his room when it's time to sleep? That's Siri will not make heads or tails of that. I'd be like, that's not one of the forms that I know how to parse. I have no idea what you're talking about. Or it'll make a bad guess, or terrible things will go wrong, right? So the idea that you have one of these large language models sitting in front of Siri, listening to what you say, figuring it out, and in this case, once it figures out what you want, also formulating a JSON message that it then sends to like Home Assistant or some other thing, or, you know, translates into the form that Siri understands it. Like, because the ChatGPT thing, like the large language model figured out, you probably mean the kid's bedroom. 20 minutes from now means that's when it should happen and you want the lights to go off. Like, it figured all that out. And then it can issue a command, hey, dingus, in 20 minutes, turn the lights off in the bedroom, and that Siri can understand that. I don't necessarily think layering things in that way is the best approach for Apple, but at the very least, it is a way to take two things that we have now, Siri, that can do a bunch of things as long as you phrase it in one of a very long list of ways, and large language models that can take a bunch of input text and figure out the most likely output text for it that fits, you know, the prompt and everything, and sew those two things together. The video is a little bit janky because obviously having to run a shortcut is not the same as being able to say, hey, dingus, and shortcuts take time to run. And you can see the edit points in the thing where it's not as seamless as you could imagine. But of course, if Apple implemented this, they wouldn't make you run a shortcut to do it. They would fuse this into Siri and they say, oh, Siri 2 now powered by quote unquote AI. And honestly, it would be better, right? Because we don't care what's happening. We don't care that under the covers, it's a language model translating it into a very text adventure style thing. All we know is that now we are able to say more things and actually get what we want from them.
It was certainly impressive. So
honestly, I would even take just simpler things. Make Siri work every time.
Imagine that.
That's really like, it fails in such weird, stupid ways so often. Like, I go on a roller coaster up and down with what I currently think about my HomePods, as I have for the entire lifetime of these products now. And I'm currently at a bit of a down phase in terms of the functionality of Siri and Apple Music. Like, it's so buggy. It's so unreliable. These are brand new products. This, like, they're so buggy. Now they're faster in their bugs. Like, they behave buggy faster. But they're still... And it's... Oh. Can somebody, like, somehow make sure that Tim Cook listens to music every single day using a stereo pair of HomePods and operating them via Siri? Like, somehow, someone make that happen. Like, somehow, in some non-creepy way, replace all the music playing equipment in Tim Cook's home and office, again, in a non-creepy way, with stereo pairs of HomePods. And just make sure that he has to operate them every single day. And let's see if maybe this product can't get a little bit better.
That or use Apple Music and any platform for any reason.
Well, because that's using Apple Music. Like, I seriously doubt he's a Spotify user. So, you know, he's going to be using Apple Music via Siri. This will be good.
I'm not sure if his main motivational driver is how frustrating he finds the products. Steve Jobs, sure. If something went wrong for him, it'd make it his mission in life to make sure that gets fixed, because he, you know, is embarrassed.
He
to
would
be
burn
a bad
the
product.
World down until it was fixed,
or at least he would try, or until he gets bored and moves on to something else. But anyway, I feel like what Tim Cook's reaction would be, to look at how the HomePod is selling, and if sales seem like in line with projections, then I guess everything's fine.
Yeah, but see, and again, the HomePod's one part of this. Like, this is why, you know, we keep harping on, hey, Siri has to be better, and not only in these, you know, cleverness ways, like as we are seemingly in full swing now of the AI revolution here, you know, the expectations people have are going to keep going up for how smart they expect it to be. But also, it still doesn't get the basics right. It still is unreliable and slow and does stupid things with basic requests very frequently. And inconsistent is another big problem that it has. It's very inconsistent. And, you know, Apple is not only going to fall behind in competitive expectations of assistance as they all move more into AI stuff, but also Apple is about to launch a brand new product that seems like it's going to be a pretty big bet the company is making, that also, by all accounts, seems like it might be pretty heavily relying on Siri for certain functionality. How are they going to do that if Siri continues to have the reputation of seeming to work a lot better in Apple executives' homes than in any other house in the world? Like, I don't know anybody for whom Siri works as well as Apple seems to think it works. And this is going to hold them back. It's going to keep holding them back. Imagine the products that they envision. I mean, look, obviously I'm talking about the VR headset thing, but, you know, also look at things like AirPods or the Apple Watch or the phone or the HomePod. Like, all of their products now involve Siri in some way to varying extents, some more reliant on it than others. But if they try to launch a product that depends heavily on Siri, they're going to present it one way, and, you know, that'll be nice, and it'll seem like everything is awesome and works. But then when we actually get the product, it's going to have all these weird inconsistencies and shortcomings, and that's going to make the product itself look and work badly. Like, and I don't want that for these products, but that it seems like Siri is such a fundamental technology to Apple's modern product line, and they keep only leaning more into that over time. And for the amount that they are relying on Siri for the operation and success of their products, they seem to be allowing it to be a very poor performer in quality. And that, it just seems baffling to me that Apple cares. They care so much about so many of the details and the fundamental technologies their products depend on, and then Siri is just miserable. Like, and I don't understand why they don't seem to put a higher priority on making that fundamental technology as good as it can be.
I almost wonder if it's because when you're on the inside, you see how the sausage is made or not, depending on how you want to look at it. And, you know, maybe they all know it's trash, but they can explain it away. Well, it's garbage because blah, blah, blah. Well, it's garbage because politics. It's garbage because, you know, servers. It's garbage because any number of reasons. And I mean, I've been told from anyone I know that works or has worked at Apple that they are their own biggest critic, which I would believe. But golly, from an outsider's point of view, and we're going to be talking about this a lot later, from an outsider's point of view, we sure can't tell, because Siri sure ain't getting better. My keyboard on my phone still wants to change W-E-L-L to W-E apostrophe L-L and vice versa. No matter what I do, it's always choosing the wrong one. Like, it sure doesn't look like anyone cares from the outside. And at some point, you know, everyone has a different line, but at some point people are going to stop being like, well, you know, it's okay. At some point, it's just going to be so frustrating that people are going to stop using these products. I mean, I don't have HomePods or any other, you know, voice cylinder in the house, because the Amazon one got way too chatty, and all it wants to do is have me talk to it and advertise things to me and so on and so forth.
By the way.
Yeah, exactly. And then I never wanted a HomePod originally because they were too expensive. And then later I just didn't feel like it was solving a need I have. And now I certainly don't want any, because I'm, you know, such a Sonos fanboy. Nobody even wants to hear me talk about it anymore. So if the HomePod, to your point, Marco, if the HomePod and Siri were amazing, if they were really and truly great, I would probably have one in the house. I haven't tried the Google stuff. And again, I don't feel like this is a need I need to fill. And maybe the Google stuff is great. And I'm waiting for John to pipe in as soon as I stop talking. But if Siri was amazing, I would probably have a HomePod by now. But why would I spend a pile of money for a HomePod, even leaving aside the Sonos stuff? Why would I spend a pile of money on a HomePod when one of the marquee features never friggin' works from everything I've ever heard? Like, why would I do that? It just seems bananas. I don't know, John, tell me I'm a dummy and that I should get some Google stuff.
We talked about this last week, like with the difficulty of Siri. One of the downsides of being early in the market, like Apple was pretty early with a voice assistant heavily integrated into its product family that does voice assistant-y things, right? Siri was 2011 or whatever, as we discussed. And people who come later with using entirely different approaches to solving this problem, like the large language models, which, you know, give you capabilities that Siri does not have, although there are, like we said, there are still gaps that a large language model can't do that Siri can do. So, you know, but anyway, using more modern technology, yeah, you're later to the market and you missed out on all those years of having products with these features, but you get to start with a newer, better technology that's on a faster, you know, trajectory. Like, it could be that however Siri is made is like sort of an evolutionary dead end in terms of how it's structured and programmed. And there are a bunch of new branches going off in other directions. For Apple to say, okay, well, Apple was early and they had this other thing, but now they can just use the new thing. Well, the problem for Apple is they can't replace Siri with something built on new technology unless it can pretty much do everything that Siri does, because you don't want to have a regression where it's like, well, you used to be able to use Siri to do these 100 things, but now we have a new quote-unquote AI-powered Siri, but it can do one-fifth of the stuff. So they've kind of, it's the curse of being early. You build up all this functionality. Siri, for all we complain about it, is integrated into so many products and it can do so many different things. And even though we don't use all those things, someone out there is relying on the fact that you can, you know, ask Siri to predict the temperature in a different country, you know, a month from now or something. And then if you come out with a new one that's powered by AI and it can't do that, they've lost functionality. So Apple has a difficult, kind of like it was with the operating system. If you build an operating system before, like memory protection and preemptive multitasking are common, you build this huge customer base and all these apps built on it. You got all those years of good money. But now when it comes time to have a modern operating system, someone who starts from scratch right now can build an operating system with all those features from day one, whereas you have to kind of retrofit it and it's a more difficult task. So it's not that bad with Siri, but I think it is actually a challenge to use better, more modern technologies to make a better Siri while also sort of replacing all the functionalities. You have to kind of do a piecemeal where it's like, well, unbeknownst to you, when you ask this, we take this path in the code and we all go off into the new, like, large language model things. But when you ask anything else, it's the old Siri path, and they slowly replace it from the inside. Like, this is just basic, you know, software engineering, product management stuff, but it is difficult. And I hope something like that is happening inside Apple. Like, there is lots of motion in the sort of AI section of the company. Granted, a lot of it has been related to ML, which was the other buzzword before AI. You know, machine learning, we've seen lots of ML-powered features being built into Apple's applications and devices, particularly around the camera and, you know, or any of the stuff. Even the keyboard autocomplete that you're complaining about was quote-unquote ML-powered, and it doesn't seem to be working out that well. But anyway, they've been doing things. It just seems like the things they've been doing have not been Siri. Siri's been sitting there being what it is, taking 6 weeks to rebuild its database in 2014. Hopefully that's better now, but not really getting better. So, I mean, maybe this is the new thing that will be, you know, we have all these like 5 to 10 year projects that we talk about in this program of like, when is Apple going to do X? And eventually they do it. And every time that happens, someone says like, well, now what are you going to complain about now that you've got the Mac Pro? Now what are you going to complain about when you got this, when you got that? It's like
there's always
something. And Siri is kind of bubbling up to the top as the, you know, long-term thing that Apple needs to deal with. They got a new file system, the Mac Pro, that they build a new one, but then they forget about it for 5 years and we freak out again. So that'll be evergreen. But like, you know, they have a laptop CPUs that don't overheat, that are really fast, low power. Like, they a lot of the things, they fixed the keyboard, right? they knocked down a lot of these things. They got a new operating system with memory protection and preemptive multitasking, right? But there's always something else. And it seems like Siri, it might be the long pole, at least until the headset arrives and we have a whole new thing to complain about.
Which apparently is going to be in early June, but we're going to talk about that. I don't know. Where are we? I feel like we got... Oh, the ChatGPT thing, right. So anything else on that before we move along?
I think we've covered it.
All right. Microsoft has threatened to restrict data from rival AI search tools, according to Bloomberg. Bloomberg writes, Microsoft has threatened to cut off access to its internet search data, which it licenses to rival search engines, if they do not stop using it as the basis for their own artificial intelligence chat products. The company has told at least two customers that using its Bing search index to feed their AI chat tools violates the terms of their contract. Whoopsies.
So, yeah. We talked about this before in the context of like artists having their artwork used as training data, you know, and whether that is legal, whether it should be legal, whether it is ethical, and, you know, how these things are going to work themselves out in court cases depends largely on who the litigants are. And in this case, it's a bunch of big companies, Microsoft and the other companies that it's licensing the stuff to. Not surprisingly, a big company thinks it's perfectly fine for them to train their large language models on every single thing they can find on the internet, but not fine for somebody else to use their search index stuff to train their models. So everyone wants, I, big corporation, should be able to get any data I want and use it to train my thing. But once I've done that, nobody can use what I've generated to train their thing, because now I've created value. See what I've done there? You can't use mine to train your thing. And it kind of gets into the whole thing of like, the argument ad absurdum or whatever it is, where you extend something to an absurd degree. Like, well, if there's no humans creating anything and it's just AIs creating things and they're not allowed to train off each other's data, eventually they all just shrivel and die in place because no one wants to share their data and no one is producing any new data. And you've already trained on everything else. And they just sort of like, I don't know. It's like the AI inbreeding, where they just shrivel up and become little shells of themselves. So yeah, there was one other story here that I actually didn't put out. Like, the U.S. Copyright Office is forming a committee to discuss researching, like, whatever. They're doing something about like the legality of copyright and AI training or whatever. But unsurprisingly, big companies think that they should get everything and nobody should get what they do, and Microsoft is trying to enforce that in their contracts, and we'll see how this all plays out. But yeah, it's great when this stuff is up and coming and it's like a free-for-all and like, oh, nobody minds, it's just an academic project, oh, this is new and exciting, nobody really cares. But then all of a sudden, when there's real money to be made and people are making products, they're like, wait a second, these as I said before, these products have no value without good data to train them on. Where does that good data come from? And what relationship is there between the data that you're training on and the product that you make from it? And Microsoft, you know, is saying, like, if we train on a bunch of this data, you can't take the stuff that we've trained to train your training. It's like, because people are putting AI generated images on the web and like in tweets and stuff like that. And then other, you know, image generation AIs are being trained on images generated from other AI things. But they say, whoa, you can't train on those. There's a product of our machine learning. You can only train on things from actual human artists. You can steal that. No one cares about them. But once Microsoft uses our technology to generate something like that, you can't train on that. It's in our contract. And there's a bunch of court cases surrounding this or whatever. So it is rapidly heading towards what will surely be a series of terrible court decisions that we will complain about on the show.
No, of course not. I mean, I just
love the idea of like Microsoft, Google, Apple, Amazon all like legally barring each other from looking at any other. Don't let your large language models look at any of my data. If you do that, your data is tainted and we own your whole company. It's like, hey, no, that's not fair. And then they'll probably do what they do with patents and everything, is they just have these cross license agreements, which they're like, look, this is annoying. We all hate it. Let's just, you know, have a giant patent cross licensing agreement that says we all agree we can use each other's patents, because the whole patent system is incredibly dumb and would destroy the entire industry if it was, you know, if it was allowed to play out. So instead, we'll just say, we giant companies agree to ignore the patents. We'll only use them to crush small companies. America.
Hey. Oh, my word. Oh, you are so right. All right. We have semi-breaking news. WWDC has been announced.
Woo!
It is going to be a week long, asterisk. It is going to be, as we all foretold, June 5 through 9. It will be in Cupertino, but mostly online. But in the same vein as last year, and again, as foretold, there will be a special event the Monday, June 5th at Apple Park, where you can sign up to get, I believe it's a free ticket if you leave aside the fact you have to travel there, that you can request to attend. They will accept requests until April 4th at 9 o'clock in the morning Pacific or noon Eastern time. And they're going to do something presumably similar to what they did last year. And I put my name in the hat. We'll see what happens. I genuinely don't know whether the three of us are going to be there or not, and we don't necessarily need to talk about that right today, but I'm hopeful that all three of us would be there, because I haven't seen you two at all, literally not once, since WWDC 2019, and that is too damn long. So yeah, we'll figure that out, figure that out amongst ourselves, but I'm excited that there are dates. I'm excited that there's a pretty good chance that I think all three of us will be there. So I'm just excited. This is good news.
You think there's a pretty good chance? Well, so we just got done complaining about Apple and Siri, and we are about to complain even more about Apple. But in between, this is like the reverse of a shit sandwich. It's like in this scenario, the shit is the bread instead of the meat. In the middle, what I'm going to say is, hey, Apple, send us press passes.
I will echo your sentiments, even though I think it's very
because otherwise it's a lottery. Like, as Apple says, invitations will be allocated by a random selection process. Right. And so we'll find out by April 5th whether we got the random. I put my name in the hat as well. Yeah, but like, the odds aren't great, because it's not like WWC. It seems like it's a smaller number of people. It's not 5,000 people they're getting invitations to.
It seems
think.
Like it's exactly like last year. Like it seems, by all accounts, if you kind of read between the lines, it seems like it is basically the same setup as last year. And what that was, you know, the one day in person at Apple's campus with the in-person kind of keynote presentation, and then everything else is online, basically. And that the in-person thing, you know, the old conference, when everyone was like in the conference center, held about 5,000 attendees. This last year at Apple's, it seemed to be about 1,000, maybe 1,500, like something in that ballpark. And I would expect about that same number this year, maybe a little bit more if they could fit. It seemed like they might be able to fit a few more people, maybe 2,000 at most. But that's probably about as high as you could expect. So, you know, it's going to be same deal as last year, basically. Some people will get there for that one day thing. If you can't get there, you don't really need to worry about missing much of anything, because all the content will be online. I'm very happy with that, honestly, because I think this new format that, you know, COVID kind of forced them into this new format, but we were kind of heading in this direction for a while, and COVID just forced them to make it like the premium, like primary experience. And it's so much better, honestly, than the old conference sessions like that were performed in person, just by the nature of what they can do with this new format. Like it's so much better as a developer resource. And so I am very, very happy that they are continuing to do this. Also, you know, downtown San Jose, most of the stores you liked are closed. And there weren't that many to begin with.
Yeah, there were only like three or four as it was. And I guess most of them are not there or wildly changed. Like the sausage place isn't a sausage place anymore. And
still, they brought the sausage back, I thought.
They brought
there's like one sausage.
Yeah, it's more of like a burger place now. At least the vegan Indian place is still there, and it's still amazing. But at least it was last summer. I don't know if it's still there now. I hope so.
Yeah,
I might take a dinner trip there this year if I can. But anyway, yeah, I'm very happy they're doing this format again, because it worked really well last year. And even though it's not the same as the old conference in terms of like there's way less reason for a lot of people to gather there in person, and because it's held at Apple's campus, which is not even itself downtown San Jose, like it's close, but it's not in downtown San Jose, and there is almost nothing around Apple's campus besides like houses and other office buildings. So there's not really like a downtown area to congregate. There's only a handful of small hotels, you know, so there's not much of like a community gathering really going on there. So it's a much smaller event for the in-person people. That being said, as I said on Under the Radar this week, if you have the opportunity to go, and if you can swing the cost and logistics of going, I would suggest it, just because it is kind of a cool pilgrimage for Apple fans. Like, it's cool to go there. It's amazing to actually walk into Apple Park and to see the actual, you know, the big circle building, to be in that, you know, tremendous cafeteria, you know, auditorium, atrium kind of thing. Like, it's an amazing experience to see this place. It's a beautiful building. It's a beautiful environment they've built around it. And it's just a really cool feeling to be there with everybody, and even though you're just watching a video in all likelihood, because that's what it was last year. Even if you're just watching a video and sitting there getting a slow sunburn because you forgot to put on the sunscreen that they literally gave you in the bag, please put on the sunscreen. It's in your bag. It's in your goodie bag. Just put it on. But anyway, like, it's cool to be there with everybody. It's cool to like to be in the crowd as everyone is seeing stuff for the first time, and you get to like feel the crowd reaction, like being at a live event, you know, because it is one. And then I also find it very helpful as a developer. I feel like it actually motivates me a lot. Like when I'm there in that environment, it's like a theme park for or a pilgrimage, as I said earlier, for Apple stuff. And so that actually really motivates me to like come home and work really hard on all the stuff they just announced. And throughout the rest of the summer, you know, the excitement fades. You actually get the beta, you realize, wow, the stuff they announced really doesn't work yet, or it doesn't do what I hoped it would do, or it's missing some functionality that I hope it will have later, or wow, this is a real pain in the butt having to deal with all these deprecations that just happened, and wow, now I have to change this whole API I've been using back here for the last 10 years because they just changed it or killed it or whatever. And so there's all this kind of like grind or pain in the butt stuff that you have to deal with later in the summer. But at that point, at the very first day that everything's unveiled, when you're there that week or that day, it's all fun. It's all like, wow, look at this. It's so amazing. And everyone's excited and everything's positive because no one's found all the crap yet. And it's like it's just a really nice experience to be there. And it is very motivating as a developer to go there. So I do strongly recommend. I mean, look, if you don't live anywhere near California, that's going to be a lot of expense and time. And so it's probably not worth it to you for objective reasons. But if you win the ticket lottery thing, and if you get the opportunity to go, and if you can handle the cost and time to get there, it's a fun pilgrimage and a fun event. It's not anything that you can put a monetary value on. It's just fun and motivating. And it's really great for that. And so it's recommended if you can swing it. And I'm going to do my best to be there.
Yeah, the only reason I'm even considering going this year is just to have the Apple Park experience that everyone had the other year. Because I still don't really want to be traveling. I don't relish being on a plane, breathing other people's air. I don't relish doing all that stuff. I don't relish getting COVID again. Many, many reasons that I would be very unlikely to go. But considering I saw everybody go all last year and how much fun they had, I think it's worth it for me to do as an experience. Because who knows how many more times they'll do it in this exact format. And who knows how long Apple Park will be the way it is, so I want to visit Apple Park. Of course, I fully expect that if I do end up going, I will be very annoyed by the fact that apparently you're not allowed to bring real cameras into Apple Park, and I'll have to take pictures with my iPhone the whole time I'm there. But, you know, what can
I'm
you
so
do?
I'm so sorry.
Well, just think of how good those pictures would be. It's so many beautiful things, and I could take cool pictures of peoples and crowds, but nope, not allowed, just iPhone only.
Does it actually say that, or is it one of those things where it's like no detachable lenses? Like there's
it's basically no real cameras. No, you can use iPhones to take pictures within limited context, but I think the thing last year was no. Maybe they did say it is no interchangeable lens cameras, but I feel like they would just basically like no cameras except iPhones is, or no cameras except phones. I guess is probably what they mean.
I don't remember that. I mean, I believe you. I do not remember.
I remember it.
Maybe I'm misremembering. Someone from Apple can tell me.
No,
but anyway,
it being kind of vague, like because what they basically intend for the rule to be is no professional photography, but that's hard to codify, and so usually it ends up being like no professional cameras. And
yeah, I think they also don't want you to have zoom lenses because all the walls are glass, and if you have like a big zoom lens, you could read things off whiteboards that are, you know.
I wonder, like, you know, if the rule ends up being like no detachable lenses, like, well, could you bring in like the Nikon P1000 and like
basically you bring in a super zoom with an 800 millimeter lens, it's like, hey, it doesn't detach.
Oh, it's a 3000 millimeter lens, but it doesn't detach. Like that's
bring a Samsung phone, and it'll just make up things on Apple's whiteboards that
there
seem
you
plausible.
Go. Yeah.
Or just bring a drone, fly it right up to the edge. I'm sure they won't notice that at all.
I think, did you go as press last year, Marco, or just regular? Yeah, so I think if you go as press, you get to do and see more stuff. Didn't they have like a day before thing where they showed you the developer center and stuff like that?
Yeah, there was a developer center tour. They were doing like various groups for that. And then there was like a hands-on area after the keynote where we got to see the new MacBook Air, and I got to be in the way of Johnny Ive's shot again, or Tim Cook's shot, sorry.
That's another reason that Apple should give us press passes.
Yeah, because then all three of us could be in the way for Tim Cook trying to handle the new product.
Too busy talking about all the stuff we did in the hands-on room. We won't even have time to complain about Apple like we're about to do.
Yes, that's it.
I mean, it actually is true. Like, that actually happens. Mm-hmm.
Oh my word. I don't know. I mean, WWDC, granted, I haven't been since 2019 and I miss the event. Golly, do I miss seeing you two and all of our other mutual friends. But it's at WWDC, at least the way I remember it, and granted it is different now, but it is exactly what Marco was describing. It's just a really great event to get you really excited about your work or about Apple, even if it's not your work, or if you hope for it to one day become your work. It's super fun. And I really hope that all three of us end up there and you know, whether we get press passes or just get very lucky with the lottery or just choose to go because we haven't seen each other in a long friggin' time, one way or another, I hope that it works out. But I don't know if there's that much more to say about this now, but I'm excited that they've announced it. I'm excited that I have a specific thing to look forward to. I'm excited that if I fly on Sunday, apparently Richmond has some airline, I forget, like Breeze or something, that does direct from Richmond, Virginia to SFO, which is stunning.
Wow.
Unfortunately, I think the return trip is like every other day or something like that. And it's not the day I would want to take back, but that's neither here nor there. Anyway, I'm just excited, and I really hope it works out for the three of us. So anything else about WWDC? We'll do more about, you know, things we expect to see when we get closer to time. We don't have a merchandise story for ATP for WWDC yet. We are working on that. No promises, but anything else about WWDC?
I would just say it's almost, I know this is rich coming from me, it's almost like seeing a live sports event versus watching it on TV.
That is rich coming from you.
Yeah. I can't even tell you which sport. But no, like, the feeling of being there, of actually seeing the building and being right there with everyone else and, you know, everyone's cheering together when something good is announced. Like, the feeling of being there is really cool and really energizing, and it's a great experience. And again, what you're paying for, but with all the travel logistics and everything, what you're paying for is that experience. You're not paying for the developer content, that's free, but you're paying for the coolness of seeing it in person live. And so that I think is the main selling point. And if you can, so that's why, like, if you get in and if you can swing the travel logistics, it's pretty cool and you should do it. You don't have to do it every year, but you should do it at least once.
Yeah, I agree. And actually, I should point out, as part of the meat in this poo-poo sandwich, you know, every Apple employee that I've met is awesome. Like, individually, Apple people are super great. We may strongly disagree with the decisions and policies of the organization, but pretty much all the rank and especially the rank and file people are pretty awesome. I mean, and I can't think of any examples that disprove the rule. Like, pretty much everyone I've spoken to, both people that I kind of know, people that I do know, and even just strangers that I find out, oh, you work at Apple, they're all super chill and super cool. And that doesn't necessarily mean you'd meet any while you're there, but just being in the proximity gives you a chance. So we'll see what happens.
I mean, frankly, like, you know, I know we're not doing like a hiring ad for them really, but like, of all the kind of Bay Area tech company or any all the big tech company, I guess, candidates that one could possibly go to work for over on the West Coast somewhere, I would go to Apple before going to anyone else. Like, it's such a cool place, and it attracts really good people for a reason. It's a really great place to work, and it's a really cool thing to see, and it's a really great team that you work with there. And so when you go there, like, you see, like, at, you know, again, you won't, as Keith said, you know, you're not like walking through the offices or anything. Like, you don't see a single desk from somebody that somebody's working at. Like, you know, you're escorted in with, you know, event staff to the lunch area, and you sit in these chairs that are set up and everything. Like, you're not walking through the design lab or anything. But any person you run into there, because you will see a lot of Apple employees there, anybody you can talk to, because it's a company that attracts really good people for lots of good reasons. And it's a heck of an event. I strongly encourage you to go if you can. I understand if you can't, because it is a huge expense to get most people to California and you know, stay in a hotel for a few days or whatever. Like, I get that, but if you can do it, it's really cool.
Yep. All right. So if you are an Apple person, I need you to tune out and come back to this episode after WWDC, because it's that time again, fellas. Let's have a chat about Radar. because it's time. Just to very, very briefly recap, Radar is Apple's internal tool. It used to be also to some degree externally visible. Now it's been replaced from an external perspective by Feedback Assistant. Radar is their internal tool. It's their bug tracker or issue tracker, what have you. It is basically the only way that we have as external people to communicate with Apple is to just throw a Radar, or really a feedback. We'll probably use the terms interchangeably, throw a feedback over the wall, where I guess it gets internally turned into a Radar, and just hope that a human eventually looks at it and does something with it. And it is a deeply hostile and awful approach to developer relations. Because, you know, I can only speak for myself. I presume that, Marco, you probably have, and you don't have to say one way or the other, you probably have at least a couple of contacts in developer relations, because you are a on the bigger side, especially as an indie person, in terms of, you know, your reach and in your company size and so on. But I don't have
You'd
anyone
be surprised.
Oh, OK, fair enough. I can tell you, I certainly don't have any sort of contact in developer relations that if I have a question, I can ask them. I have a bunch of contacts that I've made, you know, completely personally that are outside, you know, developer relations, just rank and file engineers that are friends of mine that I've made friends with, not because I'm trying to use them for any particular reason, just because they're good people like we were talking about. And I enjoy them and hopefully they enjoy me, too. But I don't have any like formal contacts within Apple for any sort of like bugs or questions or anything like that. And, you know, if I have a problem, the easiest and best way for me to get an answer is to tweet/toot about it. And most times I'll get something that'll either push me in the right direction or maybe even solve my problem. But if I have a problem, if I have like a demonstrated problem with an Apple API, I can put together a feedback, which will almost certainly not get looked at. If it is, I will get asked for sample code. Okay, fine. Which sometimes, though, takes hours to put together. Mm-hmm. It's just, this is uncompensated time, by the way. I don't know what an iOS developer contracts for, but years ago it was like $150 an hour. I'm sure it's like up around $175, $200 by now. So, you know, many hours of work to create a sample project for them, which I understand why they ask for it, but we're talking about an effective investment if, you know, if I was going to spend that time contracting myself out of like $1,000 of my time that could be used putting together a sample project for them to promptly ignore. You oftentimes get asked for a sysdiagnose, which is basically like, you know, a bunch of diagnostic information. Again, in and of itself, that's fair, but 90% of the time, it's not even necessary or useful. It's just freaking broken. And you had an experience recently, and I think you were talking about it here on ATP. I don't think it was Under the Radar, where you had said, you know, I filed a Radar, and it's something that's really broken with audio stuff, and if memory serves, and you know, you sent that across the wire and threw it over the fence, and you didn't hear squat. And this is kind of a big deal, particularly for you, but arguably for Apple in general. In fact, why don't I let you interrupt me and can you remind me what that bug was, if you recall?
Yeah, I'll dig up the number and put it in the show notes. But effectively, it was the 16.4 betas were having the audio services were reset notification, which I think is a background daemon crash. They were having that crash and reset audio services a lot whenever I would begin playback in Overcast. It was quite a common thing, way more than ever before. It was causing problems, like you'd hit play on 16.4 betas and just it wouldn't play. And then if you go and check the Overcast log, you'd see, oh, this thing crashed like three times in a row.
Cool.
And yeah, so it was a big problem like that. And I attached sysdiagnoses and, you know, the reproduction step to get it, which was pretty easy. It was like play something on Overcast and you see this in the log. And I did everything I was supposed to do. And as far as I know, that bug is still open. I never heard anything. I think it might be fixed in the last couple of betas, and now 16.4 is now out, just like as of this week. And I think it is fixed in the release version of 16.4. But it was not fixed even as recently as like 2 weeks ago. And so I was getting a little nervous it was going to get shipped to everybody. But it's, I think it's fixed now, but the bug is still sitting there open. I never heard a thing about it.
Right. So here's the thing is that I was talking with a friend of at Apple and asked just out of curiosity, hey, can you look at, you know, feedback, blah, 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 blah. We'll put it in the show notes. Just tell, I don't need to know specifics, but just has a human being looked at this feedback? Yes or no? And it turns out that yes, a human had looked at it. And in fact, apparently there was internal activity on it within 24 hours of you filing it, which no bullshit,
no bullshit.
Is incredible. That is exactly what we want to see. I am not lying. I'm not being facetious. Truly, that is exactly what you want to see.
That's amazing.
But the problem is what you just said, Marco. How did you know this? Were you aware of this?
No.
What did you get back from Apple, Marco? Would you remind me real quick?
Nothing.
Exactly.
I just loaded up the bug now in feedback system. It says recent similar reports, none. Resolution, open. No comments.
Right. It's just not, it's not really tenable. It's not really fair, maybe. I know I say that a lot. I'm trying to get better about it, but it's just, it ain't right. And it's just, that's not a way for a company who allegedly cares about developers. And what is the triad? It's Apple first, then users, and then somewhere below that is developers.
Yeah.
You know, it's not an
equilateral triangle either.
Well, that's also fair. If Apple cares about developers at all, can we have some sort of communication the other direction? And it's just, I'm not even getting into like documentation and all the other problems with Apple's, you know, the whole developer story, but this is not okay. That this is something that could be a really friggin' big deal for Overcast, like a colossally big deal.
Yeah, I was really worried about this one.
Right. And what are you supposed to do about this? And yes, okay, let's leave aside, what is it, the something instant, what's the formal name for it? I always forget. The DTS or something like that. What am I thinking of?
Yeah, the DTS ticket. So yeah, so they have, or DTS incident or whatever they call it. Yeah, so with your developer membership, the $100 a year developer membership, comes with two DTS developer tech support instances or tickets or whatever. And the idea, this is like it's kind of like a special private bespoke radar that you can raise one of these two tickets a year. If you run out, you can buy one for $50 each, I think. You can buy extra ones. And you get two a year and they don't build up. Like if you don't use them within the year, they just expire. And this actually it gets you like an actual DTS engineer to look at your problem, and they literally provide like code level support. You can include code and they will look at it and they will try it and they will try to figure out what the problem is. And I think, I don't know, this has probably changed over the years, but I think there's some like, exception where like if you have stumbled upon an actual bug that's their fault, then they don't charge you for the ticket or something like that. Like they don't deduct it from your tickets. The problem with this system, first of all, is that most developers never use it because we don't even know about it. But second of all, I've known about the system for years. I've been an Apple developer for, oh my God, how many developer memberships have I bought? 12? At least 15? Whatever it's been. Yeah, like 15 years, something like that. I've never used one. Mostly because when I first heard about them and I heard that you only get two a year, I thought, well, I better save that up for when I really need
exactly.
one. And
exactly. Exactly.
And even after I learned that you can buy one for $50 if you really need to, like if you run out, even after that, I'm like, I still consider it like this, like, you know, only in an emergency would I ever use this kind of thing. And so I never even think to do it. I forget about it all the time. I never consider it as an option. And I probably shouldn't. I really should just use it, but I just because it's so limited, I completely forget that it's an option at all.
Yeah, same. And I mean, some of this is on us, to be fair. Like, we should be employing, and I'm looking at Marco, I'm looking in the mirror, we should be employing these and seeing if it's any better. But it's just so frustrating, especially in the cases where one puts together, and I don't know if this was the case with Marco's most recent one, but when one puts together a sample project, and I'm about to give John the floor, and you did this, John, when you put together a sample project and you explain exactly what's going on, here's a very simple sample project that demonstrates the problem, and you throw that over the wall, and then crickets, and crickets, and crickets. And it's just, and I understand, in the defense of Apple, I understand that they get just an inconceivable amount of issues. I get that. But what I also get is that the current system does not work. It doesn't work for external people. And from everything I've heard from the internal people, it doesn't fucking work for them either. So who is this in service of? Yes, I know that Apple's a big company. Yes, I know that radars go back to like literally the early 90s. I get that. But at some point, what is this in service of? And don't even get me fucking started about the fact that the way in which you say that you really care about something is duplicating a radar. It's just, oh, if Marco and I agree that this is a problem, well, then both of you file it. And that's your de facto way of voting. Are you kidding me with this? Just no, that is not okay. That is not a mechanism by which you vote, is by throwing a radar across the wall that inevitably will come back with an F you, give me a cis diagnose anyway. This is just, this is not okay. And the fact that this is still a thing blows my mind. And yes, Feedback Assistant, the app, is you know, a lot better than Radar, the web app, was, but it doesn't matter. It's the whole friggin' system is broken. It's awful. And I'm gonna really lose my cool. Believe it or not, I haven't yet. So instead, I'm going to say, John, tell me your recent story about your radars and how swimmingly they went.
Well, you two are going to make me be the big company representative again, because I have spent more time in big companies than both of you.
Yeah,
probably
you're
combined.
The closest we got right now.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I've spent some time, don't get me wrong, but you have certainly spent a lot more.
So I do understand a lot of how things work here. A couple of reactions to things you two have said. When you know, like the time we spend to file a feedback, right? I would imagine that in a lot of cases, the vast majority of that time, at least I would hope, the vast majority of that time is the time figuring out whose bug it is, because, you know, all our programs are filled with bugs, right? And we have to figure out, why doesn't this work? And that takes a long time, depending on how thorny the bug is. But the only point where we're going to hopefully file something with Apple is we've done all the debugging and we have determined to the best of our ability that, no, I am using that API right. It just doesn't work, right? And it's hard to determine that because applications are complicated. APIs are complicated. We don't have the source code to the frameworks, which also complicates things. It's a thing that I'm used to as a web developer. Having the source code to all the third-party code really helps you determine, is this my bug? Am I doing something wrong? Or is this a bug with, you know, the third-party thing? And it's kind of like the beginning programmer thing saying, I think I found a bug in the compiler. You've almost never found a bug in the compiler. Right? Yeah. It's a typical beginner programmer thing, because your program does something unexpected and you think you understand how it should work, but you really don't, right? And that's how you learn and grow as a programmer. So I think, in my experience, getting to the point where you're ready to file a feedback, that's on us, not on Apple.
Yeah,
like, you can't
that.
Charge Apple for the time you spend debugging your program, right? And it's hard to get to that point. And that's why it feels frustrating, because you spend hours, days, weeks, however long, trying to figure something out, and eventually you figure it out. I think this is not even my fault. And it feels like such an injustice, because normally it's your fault. Like 99.99% of the time it's your fault, right? You did something dumb in your program. But you're like, no, I think this is a bug in one of these frameworks, which does happen, right? Then we go into the time, if you are a conscientious bug reporter, which I try to be when I actually think I have a legit bug and I'm not just complaining about a feature suggestion or some crap like that, which also goes into, you know, feedback, which is why there's so many of them, right? So I think I've got a legit issue. I will go the extra mile to make a sample application. This is after I've determined, and probably part of the way I determine that it's actually a bug in a framework is by making that sample application. So some of that time is attributable to me, really, because you get frustrated. You're like, wait a second. I think, you know, forget about my app. Forget about all my code. Forget about stuff I'm doing. Fresh, clean sheet of paper, new project Xcode. Let me see if I can reproduce this. I got my real code here and I got my toy one, and they kind of like meet in the middle until I can get the toy one to reproduce the problem with the minimum number of code. And that's your sample project, right? So some of that time building that is, you know, is you figuring out where the bug is, because very often, as happens to me plenty, I make the trivial sample project, or more often these days I use Playgrounds, which has its own set of bugs. But anyway, use Playgrounds to do something. And if it works right in Playgrounds, or it works right in your toy example, but it doesn't work right in your real app, that's still probably your bug, right? That happens all the time. But sometimes it goes the other way. So when it goes the other way, you're like, all right, I'm going to polish up this sample project. I'm going to file the bug. At this point in your head, you understand the issue, because you have boiled it down. You have debugged it. You have figured out when you do X and Y and Z, Q should happen, P happens instead. You've already figured that out. And you're like, I'm serving this up to you, Apple, on a silver platter. Mm-hmm. I've got a sample project. Mm-hmm. The source code to the sample project is on a public GitHub URL. A zip of it is included. There's a sysdiagnose that the feedback app already ran. I can describe in 5 sentences. Here's the problem, expected results, actual results. It fits on a page. You could print this on an index card. Here it is. A bunch of things could happen at that point. One is that you may be perhaps one of the best, but one of 1,000 people who sent that bug to Apple and they already know about it. Right. And we would hope in a sane system that there would be some communication that says, yeah, no, we know about that one. It's been 50 people who have filed in, right?
One would think.
Right. Yes. But anyway, that could happen. The other thing that could happen is that could just never get looked at because it's the bottom of a big pile and you would never know. But usually, especially if you have a tech podcast that Apple people listen to, or you toot about it or whatever, someone will listen to the program and look at the bug or whatever, and then get to us through back channels that X, Y, and Z is happening, right? But you know, there's a lot of these bugs, and it's difficult to, get to all of them in a timely manner. You can't expect, and honestly, like bugs that I file for my stupid apps, Apple should not look at, like for the purposes of my app, because like who cares about my app? The only time they should look at them is because, oh, all right, we don't care about, you know, John's apps because whatever, who cares, right? But if this is actually a bug in our framework, this could affect, you know, Photoshop or like a real app that people care about, right? If it's a legit bug in the framework, especially if it's a new bug, it didn't exist in the last version of the OS and it does exist in this one. It's a regression, as they say. That's worth lurking at, not because of my apps, but because tons of apps use these frameworks. I'm not using super obscure frameworks. So if I have found a legit bug or a legit change in behavior, someone should look at that. How do you determine that? There's a big pile of bugs. How many of them are people saying, I think the color of this button should be purple? And how many of them are a carefully reproduced bug with a minimal sample project, right? That's a legit bug that affects Microsoft Office. You need people to sort through all those things, triage them, and figure out which is which. And Apple doesn't seem to be particularly good at doing that either. Forget about the communication part of it, right? So the most recent one I had, and I do this, you know, I found a handful of bugs and I made little sample projects about it. The most recent one I found was interesting, or the one I'm going to talk about here was interesting in that it was a straight regression. What was the past one? Monterey? I'm losing. I don't write these reviews and they're not cat names. I don't remember anymore. Ventura, what was the one right before? It was Monterey, right?
I don't know. I think so. I can never keep them straight either.
This is so sad that we can't remember the name of the last Mac OS.
Well, we're
version.
All old men and no, none of us live in, have never lived in California, so whatever.
Yeah, all kind of blends together.
Chat room, just tell us so we don't embarrass ourselves.
I think we've already embarrassed ourselves. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's already
ship has
happened.
Sailed.
No, because we got to follow up with it because now people are like listening to the podcast and they're tuning in telling us what it is. And then we need to have the thing 15 seconds later in the show where we say,
yes,
the name
all right. I already looked it up. Stop talking. It's Ventura. Then before that was Monterey. Before that was Big Sur.
Okay, I got it. All right. Anyway.
You did.
This is a thing that worked in my app in Monterey and didn't work in Ventura. Which right away makes me think this might be some kind of behavior change. And then I go look at the release notes, because when the new versions of the OS come out, they have like a framework level release notes. Hey, if you use this framework, here's what's changed in this thing, right? Because they change things. So this used to do that. This is deprecated. You know, we added these functions. We removed those. We changed this. Like nothing about this in any of the release notes. I look at the documentation of Ventura. Documentation doesn't say anything about this. There's a thing in AppKit that... you can put on a view that tracks when the cursor enters it and like tracks where the cursor is or whatever. It's called NS tracking area. And I use it to track when the cursor enters area. I'm using it for its intended purpose, right? In Monterey, it worked as I expected. In Ventura, it would track the cursor normally, except if you were dragging something. And then if you were dragging something and it's tracking error, it'd be like, I don't see any cursor. I don't know what you're talking about. It would not track at all. And that broke a feature of my application because I needed to track it when things are being dragged, right? And I was debugging it for a while. I'm like, why does this not work? Anyway, found the bug, isolated it, made a minimal reproduction sample application. You don't even need to read anything. I always put all the text in the app. Like when you launch the app, it has text that says, here, do this, do that. Well, I expect this to happen. And that happens, right? You don't even need to read the README, right? Made the sample app, submitted it. Again, the fact that my app broke in Ventura, not a big deal. But if this is a legit change in behavior for NS tracking area, that is a commonly used thing in applications. It is it's from AppKit. Lots of applications use AppKit. And, you know, that's a significant piece of functionality that just doesn't work anymore. I didn't get any response or whatever.
eventually I added a comment to the thing, or someone did respond to it because I probably complained about it on probably back then Twitter or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And said, oh, you should, you know, what is, they asked me, what is your application or whatever? And they said, actually, you should be using the drag handling thing to handle drag, so on and so forth. You know, there was actually some feedback. I'm like, okay, right. Well, so I understand that I could use the drag thing, but like it worked in Monterey and doesn't work in Ventura. Is NS tracking area just not going to track drags anymore? Because if that's the case, like I was trying to get like, was this an intentional change, or are you just telling me, hey, there's a bug, but you can work around it in this way? Or are you telling me from now on NS tracking area will not do this? So just get used to it. And if that's true, you should probably update the documentation and release notes and say, oh by the way, from now on NS tracking area won't do this or whatever. So I added a comment to the task that said, or to the feedback that said, you know, my application is whatever. And I, you know, I've since added a workaround to, you know, using the drag handling to do this. Like I said, if you're on Ventura, use the drag handling, but, you know, whatever. And the next response I got in feedback was, great, we've closed your bug. Yeah. So it basically said, hey, I'll read you the text, which is not great. Sorry. Let's see. Thank you for letting us know that your issue has been resolved. You can close this feedback by selecting close feedback via the actions button found above. As you've indicated this issue is resolved, this feedback will no longer be monitored and incoming messages will not be reviewed. Should you find the issue that the issue is still present, please file a new feedback report. So this is like double whammy, because like one, I wasn't saying it's resolved. I was saying I found a workaround, which programmers do all the time. Like, oh, if there's a bug or a change in behavior, you can code around it or whatever, right? And two, saying, oh, and by the way, don't even bother responding to this, because even though we can't close this issue for you and we want you to close it yourself, we're just never going to look at it again. And if you think this issue is still there, file a new bug. So I did file a new bug and said, I think it's still there, because I don't know what you're telling me here. Again, my question was, is this like intentional new behavior, or is it a bug that you're going to eventually fix? Not that I care that much, but it is basic functionality. And I complained about it on Mastodon, and Apple people saw it. And so eventually I got someone to respond to the task and explain the situation.
But John, running to the press never helps.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Explain the situation in English, basically saying, this is an intentional change. We think this is the way it's supposed to work. It's not going to work the other way. Yes, we know we haven't updated the documentation or put anything in release notes, and we've already filed separate, you know, internal radars to deal with that or whatever. Here's what I'm going to say about this particular experience. I'm not going to say, oh, why didn't my bug get fixed and why did it take too long and all this other stuff, because honestly, who cares, right? What I am going to say is that from a policy perspective, one of the things that Apple should really work on, setting aside all the things we already talked about, like, oh, you know, be better, right? Is like, when you get to a point where a human being has somehow found their way to my feedback, whether it's because I have a podcast and post it on Mastodon, or it's just random luck. At some point, hey, you come up in the rotation. Your feedback is being triaged. A human being has now got 37 seconds to look at your feedback and do something with it. I think one of the worst things that they do now that they can fix without really spending any more money or time or whatever is when a human does that, make sure you spend that time doing something useful, because your net, like, that's not going to come back again. I'm going to have to wait. Like the time gap between some of these things sometimes is like weeks or months between any response, right? So in that moment when the human is looking at it for 37 seconds, please, human, like, spend the extra 5 seconds to write a coherent sentence, because we know no one is going to look at that again for 3 months. This is the one chance I get for my bug to have its time in the sunshine. And all I wanted as a human with reading comprehension skills to say to me, this is intended behavior. We're sorry that it's not documented, but just FYI, it's going to work this way from now on. That's it. And that wouldn't take any more time than the sentence that I just read you, like, or the feedback that was in there. It's actually a shorter sentence. Spend the time that you have, which is small and not enough, spend that time wisely, because it wastes all of our time to get a response, which we have all gotten. Every developer has gotten this, a response that makes you think the person writing it either A, isn't a person and is a bot, or B, did not read anything in your feedback. If a response like that is
put in ostensibly, because I'm told these are all done by humans. If a human spends their 37 seconds to give a response that makes the person who posted it think that they didn't read the feedback, either A, they didn't read the feedback, which is bad, or B, they wasted that time. So my one, in this particular round of being mad about radar and feedback, my one plea for Apple is, in the tiny slice of time, humans' time that we get, in the two small slice of human times that we get, please let them do a reasonable job of feedback, because it will save all of us so much time. It wastes so much more time to have three rounds of back and forth with a month between each round than to just have the person write a coherent sentence on the first one that sounds like a human, not like a PR machine, and that reflects the fact that they saw the bug. That's what really bothered me about this. Secondarily, if anyone is listening or whatever, I think it is insane that NS Tracking Area, which has an option called enabled during mouse drag, now does not work during mouse drag. And I await anxiously the updated documentation how are they going to document the enabled during mouse drag option? They're going to say this used to enable during mouse drag, but it totally doesn't anymore. Sorry about that. I think that's dumb. But that's the type of thing, like, if it was an open source project, I'd be in the issue arguing, like, I think this is a bad change in NS Tracking Area. You're breaking apps for no reason. There's an option called enable during mouse drag. What the hell, right? You can't have that argument with Apple, because it would be 3 months between replies. And by the way, they already said they're not monitoring this bug, so you'd have to be refiling it every single time. Like, that's pointless. That's the time-wasting open source arguing over bugs that Apple actually, you know, as a happy accident of their terrible feedback system, avoids or whatever. But setting that aside, I'm willing to say, just tell me, Apple, just tell me this is the new way it is. Communicate that successfully. Communicate that you know that you haven't documented it, right? And by the way, on this particular issue, as far as I can tell, I mean, I don't know, because obviously we don't know what happened inside Apple, and we just talked about how there's no, you know, communication. But like, it seems like what happened is whatever team is responsible for NS Tracking Area or that whole framework or whatever decided they were going to make this change, probably for like some efficiency reason, or it's like someone thought it would be a good idea. Like, this happens all the time. It, you know, we've decided that the behavior of this needs to change. And even though it's going to be annoying for some people, it'll have fewer bugs, it'll have better performance. Like, I get it, right? So they thought they were going to do this, setting aside the fact that there's an enable during mouse drag option, whatever. But they were going to do this. But it seemed like they were going to do it, and they knew it might break some applications, but they didn't want to mention it in the release notes or document it, because they were like, fingers crossed, maybe this won't break anyone's app, and I hope no one notices.
Don't tell anyone.
Which totally happens. You're like, Apple, the big company, we're never going to do that. Trust me, this absolutely happens, because the incentives are structured for you not to go, oh, this has to be in the release notes, and then we have to make, you know, we have some policy that was made 10 years ago that says if you do any breaking change to AppKit, you have to clear it with Microsoft explicitly to make sure it doesn't break Office. Like, can we just make the change and put it in the betas and maybe just no one will notice? And here I am with my dinky little app that five people run saying, oh, excuse me, I noticed the NS Tracking Area. And they must be like, damn it, somebody noticed. And it's an app that doesn't matter, so who cares? But it's a stupid guy with a podcast, right? And you know, I don't fault those engineers for trying to slip one under. I have 100% done this so many times, and I've been caught doing it, and I've also snuck a bunch through, and it feels really good when you sneak them through. It's like, look, I'm just going to change the behavior, and I bet nothing's going to break, and if I just don't say anything, it'll be fine. But I'm going to say that's also probably not the best way to do things. So whatever incentives are structured to make engineers want to sneak this out without putting any release notes, change those incentives, because engineers should be incentivized to do the right thing, which is, hey, we're changing the behavior of this. It's in the release notes. We updated the docs. Sorry if it breaks your app. And if it breaks too many apps, we'll roll it back. But just wanted to know this is a change, because that would have saved me a little bit of my time on my app. And who knows? Maybe it did break, you know, Microsoft Office or something. And there's some other, you know, feedback about that. But yeah, that's today, this year's, this month's, whatever advice for Apple is, spend the tiny slice of time you have wisely, because it wastes most of our time if you don't. And I don't think it actually requires any more time. It just requires slightly differently spent time. Above and beyond that, not to go over all the things we've talked about a million times before, but I do feel like there is a big difference between a bug report, a concise bug report with a minimal sample project that's on GitHub from a known good developer, and a random feedback about the color of a button from someone you never heard of before. And it's the same thing with the App Store, that it is frustrating when like a company like Panic, that should be like AAA white glove gold tier status in Apple developer, can't get their game through to the App Store, their famous, well-reviewed game that's on a million other platforms from the company panic, while scam apps sail through, right? You know, the goal of these systems, these faceless bureaucracies, is not to be a roulette wheel for outcomes. There should be some, when you're triaging things, you should take into account the quality of the report, who it's coming from. They certainly do for Adobe, Microsoft, you know, the big companies like that.
Funny how that is.
but they should also triage based on, like, you know, is there a sample project historically? Like, give it, it's like Uber drivers and ratings, right? Like, give the developers a rating. This person, Daniel Jalkut, 5 stars, gives amazing bug reports, always very concise, always technically accurate, hardly ever makes a mistake, hardly ever blames the compiler, comes with a sample project, is smart, is responsive. Like, look at those first. Like, you're triaging. You can't look at them all. There's too many. When you triage, bubble up the good ones, have a system of, like, rating them. And then getting to Casey's point about, you know, I have to file a second one, why can't I do? But public issue tracking systems have this solved. We all know that. Apple's usual response is, well, we can't use public issue tracking because, you know, Adobe sends the source code to Photoshop and you can't have them up or whatever. And the answer to that from us has always been, let people opt into it. Yeah. Let developers say, I agree that anyone can see this bug report. Mm-hmm. You know what? It's on me. I'm saying market is public. I'm not going to put Photoshop source code in here. What I am going to put is my little sample project that I made. And I'm going to say everybody can see this, because then they can send the link to all their friends who will go to that URL and hit the Me Too vote up button on the thing instead of having to file something themselves. These are all imminently solvable problems without hiring more people, except for to, you know, improve the system, which they already did once with the feedback thing, without staffing up, so on and so forth. And then I guess the final thing I'll say is app review used to be, believe it or not, way worse than it is in terms of how long things would go through.
Oh, so much worse.
And then at some point, something happened inside Apple and app review got faster. Did they do that by cutting corners and getting worse quality? Maybe. But the point is, it got faster.
By firing somebody.
Yes. Yeah. Or, you know, whatever had to happen. I'm not saying, you know, there's easy solutions. Oh, we'll just spend less time and do a worse job and we can do more of them. And I'm not even sure if that's the right trade-off. But the point is, it is possible for big things to change inside Apple. It's happened before with App Review. It can happen with feedback and radar. It is not a intractable problem. Yes, they'll probably have to spend more money and hire more staff or whatever, but whatever it is that they did to make App Review way, way, way faster, and I think we would all agree that that's a net win. Like, the quality still sucks and they still do terrible things like rejecting Panic games, you know, and this is all the horror stories. That all still there, but I feel like that's about been a constant, but the time has gone way down. So if the time between me getting useless, you know, incoherent feedback responses was 3 days instead of 3 weeks or 3 months, I would feel a lot better about it. So I feel like it is possible for Apple to change and improve feedback. I don't know what has to happen for that to happen, but I know it's possible. I know you can do it, Apple, right? There are basic suggestions that you ask any developer, you pull someone off, Apple developer off the street and say, what could we do to improve feedback? They have 7 ideas for you. They're all good. Just take them. Like, they're so obvious. Everybody knows what they are. Doesn't mean they're easy. Doesn't mean that you can do them overnight. Doesn't mean you don't have to hire new people. Like, I understand, but this is an important part of the company, kind of like App Review, an important part of the developer ecosystem that was really, really, really bad, making improvements, and it pays dividends. Please do this.
Yeah, you know, and one of the things I wanted to talk about in this conversation, and we're already running a bit long, so I'm going to try to make this quick, but what, you know, we love, the three of us in particular, love to whine about, well, you know, why isn't such and such better? Why isn't it better? And I think one of the things that we can do is talk about, you know, well, how could this become better? And I think what you're saying, John, is excellent. You know, if a reviewer is looking at it, like, really properly look at it. If it's more than just a, this is broken, do something about that. If there's a sample app, run the sample app, you know, acknowledge that this reviewer or that this submitter has done good work. Look, and like you said, have a rating system or something like that. Oh, you know, Daniel Jalkut always writes amazing bug reports. We should pay attention to him. Maybe even, and this is going to be weird, Apple, but maybe even reply to him. Wouldn't that be amazing?
Whoa.
I know, right? Isn't that, this is some real new thought technology. You know, and you know, Casey, all he does is fuss and moan. He never includes a sample app. That's not true, but for the sake of discussion, he never includes a sample app. Oh, he doesn't deserve a reply. Well, you know what? Okay, that's kind of deserved. But another thing that I've been thinking about is, Apple will never, ever tell us what they're doing internally, which I don't think that has to be the case, but you know, it's Apple. I understand it. That's fine. But what if there was like some sort of indication on the public facing feedback, the last time that anyone within Apple has touched this? We don't know what they've done. We don't know if they just opened it and closed it immediately, but somebody touched this a week ago, a day ago, 2 days ago, and then fast forward a week and it says today. Then you don't have to tell me a damn thing. I at least know, assuming this isn't just, you know, fakery, I at least know that some friggin' human being has looked at this in the last 6 months. That would make me feel at least a little bit better, probably even so much better, because at least I know things are I don't know what's happening. Maybe I won't see the results of it for a year, but at least I know somebody cares enough to have looked at it in the last week. And now, of course, I could argue on the flip side of that is, well, most of these are probably going to get looked at once, never again. Well, we already know that. You're not telling us anything we don't already know. Like, who cares? Put in writing. Maybe somebody who actually gives a shit up high will be able to do something about it. Like, there's so many, like John said, there's so many ways to fix this. And it's just, there's so many ways to fix this. And if any one of them, you know, I would like, I am in hell and I would love a cold glass of water. Please, anything. Anything, Apple, please. And my favorite, by the way, my favorite slap in the face, and I think, John, you just had this happen recently, is, oh, here's something you reported years ago, which kudos to Apple for keeping it around and having looked at it years later. But nevertheless, here's something that happened years ago, and we think we fixed it. Hey, you want to do me a solid and go check? Well, okay, fair enough. But, John, what happens if you don't check immediately?
Well, actually, it wasn't a years ago one. It was a thing where they said, and this is, we'll link to in the show notes to who's Lapcat Software? Who's that guy? I don't think.
Jeff Johnson, is that right?
Yes, Jeff Johnson. Had a similar complaint to mine, but yeah. Filed a thing, they fixed it, or they said it was fixed, and they do the thing which I think is good, which is, hey, don't just close the bug when you fixed it. Actually get the person who opened the bug to agree with you. The yes, I agree, you have fixed it, so we can close the report. That would be a good system if we weren't sending messages to each other by carrier pigeon, right? Because it takes 3 months for anything to get back and forth, so that kind of makes it dumb. But anyway, I'd filed something, they said, we think this is fixed, and Apple's thing that they've been doing lately, as in the past few years, is they'll send you the "we think it's fixed" message, incoherently written in a way that you have to read seven times to figure out what the heck they're even talking about. You know, as you'll see, like, "we think this is fixed," and they'll give like a build number. And you're like, wait, what OS is that? What beta is that? How do I get that? How do I install that? They'll tell you basically, "we think it's fixed in a beta." And what they want you to do is, oh, just try your, you know, try your app or your sample program in this beta of the operating system and let us know whether it's fixed. You know, one of mine was they said, you know, they sent this bug, and it wasn't one of my good bug reports. It was one of my bad ones. It was from a user's perspective. It was related to my program, but like, there's like a thing is happening in system settings that I don't think should be happening based on what my program does. And they're like, it wasn't a great bug report. So they said, we think we've got it fixed. Can you confirm it in a beta? And my answer, you know, I didn't say anything, but like my reading it was like, I don't have a good way to install a macOS beta. I'm not going to install it on my main machine. I don't have a drive available. All my laptops have been lent out to like kids. My son had to take two laptops to college so he had to run a VM on an Intel Mac, but he has an ARM Mac. And anyway, it wasn't convenient for me to install a beta anymore. So I just had the Casey style childlike satisfaction of them saying, please let us know if this is fixed in the last beta. And then I just ignored it. Right? I mean, because like, but you know, I could have responded and said, oh, I don't have time to install a beta. But like, bottom line is, okay, how about I let your thing sit there unresponded for 6 months? See how you like that. How about I leave your thing under? I know Apple, suddenly you want my feedback and you're sending me emails every week saying, hey, just so you know, your feedback, we asked for, you know, we need a response from you. We need some feedback. Engineering needs you to confirm this. They would send you emails every week or two saying, you know, letting you know that you're supposed to respond. And I would just ignore them and be like, I don't have, like, not because I'm being mean and spiteful, but I literally don't have time to install a beta to figure that out. And what I figured was, you know, the new public version of macOS will come out and then I'll be able to see if it's fixed, right? That's what I figured would happen, right? Instead, what happened is after, in my case, 35 days, Apple said, we're just going to close your bug. We didn't hear from you, so later. Right. And basically, so the tolerance of Apple, I thought it was like on a fixed timer, but apparently not, because Jeff Johnson had only waited like 16 days. Like, when they ask you, hey, confirm that this is fixed, if you don't respond on their timetable, they'll just say, well, we waited a while and we didn't hear from you, so we'll just assume it's fixed. Done. Bye. Which is not the way it should work. If you're going to have the system where we don't close it until the developer confirms that it's fixed, you have to wait for them to confirm. And if basically no response, you assume, well, I'll assume it's fixed. Why would you assume it's fixed? Maybe I'm dead. And that's why I didn't respond. You don't know what's going on over here. Oh, I didn't respond to your confirmation. Then you can't be like, that must mean it's fixed. I'm closing it out, right? At least let the release version of the OS come out, because I'll update. Because I'll update to the latest version, and then I'll be able to tell. And by the way, it's not fixed, but I'll update to the latest version, because 13.3 is out. It's totally not fixed. It's a bad bug report. I don't want to get into it. Like, I don't blame Apple. This is a really complicated issue. I don't even know how to fully report this, but it's doing something that it shouldn't be doing, or maybe it should be. It's hard to tell without talking to a human, but it's a minor issue. I don't really care that much about it. But Jeff Johnson has a similar story. His was closed after 16 days for the same reason. He's like, I don't have a good way to install a beta. I'll just wait for the release. Oh, never mind. They closed it before the release came out. Apple's internal system patience for lack of response from developers seems very low. Whereas we file things and months, weeks, years go by and we hear nothing. We're expected to just tolerate that, right? So it is a very asymmetrical relationship. And I think the Apple's policy surrounding this is not great. I would actually argue for inside Apple, if you think you fixed the issue, to save us all time, close the bug. Say closed, we think it's fixed as whatever. And I know they have this weird thing where you can't reopen bugs, which just seems like a real problem with their system. But like, if you wait for all developers to confirm, it's going to take you forever. And they don't actually wait for you to confirm. They'll auto-close it after N days anyway. So it's like, just be honest and say, when you think you fix it, just close it as resolved. Say, resolved, fixed in macOS, blah, 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 blah. Because then there's a known resolution. And if I come back to it, I'm on vacation. I come back from vacation. I'm like, oh, looks like my bug was closed. And they said it was fixed in macOS, blah, 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 blah. I can confirm that at any time at my leisure. If I care about that bug, presumably macOS has rolled on since then, and I'll try to reproduce it. And if it's not fixed, in a sane world, I would reopen the bug. But in this world, I can refile it, right? You don't have to wait for me to confirm and send me nagging emails and then just close it anyway when I don't respond for 2 weeks. All right, that was just a little bonus content there, so I can link to the Jeff Johnson thing. But that policy also seems counterproductive, let's say, because it's pretending that a relationship exists that doesn't actually exist, which is like, we're talking back and forth. We're working together on this bug. No, we're not. We're throwing things over the wall, and you are occasionally popping up every few months to ask us to do something which may be inconvenient for us.
Yeah. And as a final note on this, I in the same vein as what I was saying about Siri, like, I think that there's a lot of people within Apple that would agree that Radar is perhaps not optimal, but I don't think that most people, even potentially the rank and file, really understand how aggressively awful it is for third-party developers. And here again, it's one of those things where I think it's easy for Apple to be like, eh, it's not great for us either, you know, or, eh, you know, you don't really understand how many we get, or, eh, it's really, really a hard problem to solve, which all of those things are true. But ultimately, that doesn't matter. At some point, you need to fix the problem. At some point, Siri needs to be better than a pile of trash. At some point, Radar and Feedback Assistant need to be better than just throwing thing into dev null and hoping for the best. Like, it doesn't matter if you can excuse yourselves away from why this is bad. I don't care. You all make a ridiculous amount of money to solve really hard problems. Here's a really hard problem to solve. Fix Radar. It's actually not that hard, but still, fix Radar. Please and thank you. All right, can we do some Ask ATP to cheer me up, please?
Yes, please.
All right. Steven Goza writes, John and others have mentioned a bunch about Mastodon being federated, and I can't wrap my head around it. I ignored it for a while until last week, which was probably 2 months ago, when John said an instance could become, quote, unfederated, quote. Now I can't ignore my confusion anymore. Would love an explanation when you have a chance, which unfortunately that time didn't come until now, but now we have the chance. So John, what does federating or federation mean?
usually people use the email analogy, and I will use that briefly here before I try a different one as well. So the email analogy is you can pick an email provider, Gmail, Hotmail. You can host your own email in your own domain, you know, whatever, iCloud Mail, all that stuff. That is kind of your instance. You know, you can email me at my name at iCloud.com, at my name at Gmail.com or whatever. You pick Gmail, you picked iCloud, you picked Yahoo, you picked Hotmail. Those are your instances, right? But you can send email to anybody. When they say, oh, just send me your email address. You don't look and say, oh, I can't email you. I'm on Gmail and you're on Hotmail. No, you know that you can send an email to anyone on any other email instance because that's how email works. It is a federated system, kind of, right? So in Mastodon, we have little Mastodon addresses. It's your username at your instance. They look kind of like email addresses, but we put another ad of the thing. So mine is at Syracuse at Mastodon.social, right? It's like an email address, right? But I can follow people on any other instance, and they can follow me the same way we could email each other if we are on different email instances or servers or whatever. That's what federation means. The more precise or slightly more precise technical explanation, which still glosses over some details, is the Mastodon.social server that I'm on. It talks to other servers to find out what's happening on them. And the way it does that is it looks all the people who have accounts on Mastodon.social. What is the, I'm going to give you a SQL query now. Give me the unique list of instances that people follow on this server. So, you know, 500 people follow someone from this instance, one person follows from this instance. Just give me the unified list of all the instances. Those are the instances that Mastodon.social needs to talk to. It doesn't need to talk to all the instances in the world, because if nobody on Mastodon.social follows someone on Fubar.social, it doesn't need to talk to that thing at all, right? And vice versa. So it can figure out who do I need to talk to. And then periodically, they communicate using the ActivityPub protocol to exchange information. Tell me what the people that my people follow are saying. And by the way, here's what my people are saying. And I will send that to all the other instances that for the people that follow them, right? So you can sort of see how they work in the same way that an email server will receive email from anybody who sends it and then will allow email to go out or whatever. Unfederation is something that kind of also happens in email as well, where an instance, where one instance will decide, like, for example, Hotmail. If Hotmail decided, you know what? We're not going to allow any more email from Gmail users. Not that they would ever do that, but just humor me, right? That would mean that if you're on Gmail and you send email to someone at Hotmail, it would bounce back and say, nah, sorry, I couldn't deliver the email. The Hotmail server said they're not accepting email from Gmail anymore, right? That happens with spammers, where like there's some you know, thing that's emailing and it's spamming, right? The big email services like Gmail, Hotmail, Yahoo, iCloud will unfederate, blacklist or whatever.
By the way, I'm pretty sure it's called defederate.
Yeah, defederate. That's right. Sorry. And hello, future Marco. I will correct that again. You know, the big email servers will have a deny list that will remove all of the spam servers that they don't want to receive email from. Right. So you can imagine with a federated system like this, especially with something like Mastodon that's not quite the same as email, you could draw them out as little islands. You could have an island of instances that all talk to each other, but they don't talk to this other island of instances, or maybe there's one or two connections or whatever. So it's not like there's just one giant pool, and if you get defederated, you're off to the side. It could break up into a whole bunch of little islands with sparse connections between them and lots of internal connections. We'll see how this is going to shake out. But in the case of Mastodon, defederating is considered a feature, not like a burden, because email is supposed to be universal communication. Setting aside spammers, anyone should be able to email anyone else. But on a social network, the instance can set rules for behavior. You know, for instance, just off the top of my head, you could say this instance does not allow anyone to use curse words, right? And everybody who doesn't want to see curse words could be on that instance, and they might decide, that instance might decide to defederate from any other instance that allows the use of curse words. If they did that, anyone who's on that instance would be like, wait a second, I used to follow person over there. Now I can't see their stuff anymore. And they say, oh, well, we don't want curse words coming into our instance, so we defederated from them. And that person might say, oh, that sucks. I'm leaving this instance and going to an instance that is federated. And in that way, people would sort themselves into groups according to who they are willing to be federated with or whatever.
in practice, what we mostly expect is there'll be a reasonable set of behavioral rules that the vast majority of people will agree upon, and defederation will only happen when like a Nazi or a child porn server or some terrible thing comes and they'll be defederated, and it'll kind of be like the civilized world of people who have basic standards for behavior. And, you know, because defederating is like the nuclear option, right? You can always just not follow people, and you can block individual people, and you can mute people, and you can do all those types of things. Defederation is like, look, this entire instance is filled with Nazis. It's so bad, it's unredeemable. If any good people are there, I'm sorry, but we're going to defederate from you or whatever. And so we don't know how this is going to work out. This is kind of the first time this is being done at a large scale, where defederation is a feature of the system and not just something they use to deal with spam and abuse, but just, you know, a potentially ideological tool or a way for people to sort them into different bins. As I said in past shows, it may be the case that what happens here is kind of what happened with emails. You get a bunch of really big instances that are kind of too big to fail and that could never defederate from each other because it would break the entire system. And that would be kind of a shame, because that kind of defeats the purpose of federation when you have these, a duopoly or whatever, really big things. But we'll see how it shakes out. So that's how Mastodon is structured. That's how it's supposed to work. We'll see how it's going to actually work in practice.
Yeah, really quick shout out to the Decoder podcast, which I don't personally listen to every episode, but everyone I've heard has been very good. Is that the one you were just on, Marco, actually?
No.
Okay, sorry. Well, anyway, they just had on Eugene Rochko. I probably butchered that pronunciation. I'm sorry about that. But he is the benevolent dictator for life for Mastodon, and it's like an hour and a quarter. It was really, really, really good. I just listened to it a few hours ago, so that is worth listening to. And it's clear that he is someone who, whether or not you agree with him, deeply cares about Mastodon and deeply cares about doing the right thing. And I think I generally agree with a lot of the things he said, except maybe quote tweets or quote toots, but that's neither here nor there. But they talk a bit about federation in this, and I really think it's a fascinating case study on, you know, can communities really self-govern? What happens if they turn kind of evil? You know, what is this all going to mean? This is what you were talking about earlier, John. But the conversation with the guy who created Mastodon is really, really, really interesting. And so if you have the time, I definitely suggest it. We'll put a link in the show notes. All right, moving on. Eric Smith wants to know, is software getting worse? And this is a blog post on the Stack Overflow blog from late January. And it talks about, you know, is software legitimately getting worse? And so someone, I presume John, pulled some quotes for me to read from this blog post. I suspect bugs per line of code is more or less staying constant, but applications are much more complex than they were, leading to more bugs in the absolute number sense. Also, the threshold for a quote-unquote bug has changed over time. For example, tearing and frame latency were considered normal. Now they're a bug. I don't think that expanding the set of bug is terrible, but a byproduct of that will be that it's hard to keep that set small. Thoughts, gentlemen?
There's an old adage in software, which is one of those old adages that no one really has the wherewithal to actually test, but people hear and it rings true to them, so we keep repeating it, so here I am doing that. It's that the number of bugs per line of code written by a programmer hasn't changed that much over the years. You know, there's a range, it's a bell curve or whatever, but in general, if you're going to write 1,000 lines of code, how many bugs on average do you expect to find in 1,000 lines of code? And that makes some sense. Obviously, not all lines are created equal, you know, it depends on what language you're writing it or whatever. But in general, if you're going to write 1,000 lines, there's some average percentage amount of bugs you're going to have. And then you debug, and there's various software testing methodologies and QA and stuff to remove those bugs and make the software as bug-free as time and money will allow, right? That is a well-known thing. I don't think that's changing much. Mostly, and the reason most people believe that is because although the software industry and technology advances by leaps and bounds, humans change way slower. And so in the blink of an eye between, you know, the invention of electricity and today, like, human evolution has done nothing, right? Except for maybe like work up some immunities to some viruses and stuff, but like just generally nothing. So it's not as if, oh, because humans are faster, we'll get so much better at programming that we'll make fewer mistakes. No, we're pretty much making the same amount of mistakes. And incidentally, this particular argument very often comes up in the context of high-level versus low-level languages, which we've talked about many times in the past. And it's why proponents like me of high-level languages say,
No matter how much you love C or C++ or assembly or whatever you may be arguing for, or Objective-C or whatever, the bottom line is higher level languages let you write fewer lines of code. And even if you think it's all syntactic sugar or it's pointless or it's taking me too far away from the internals and I need a lower level or whatever, the unescapable fact is the more things you type, the more opportunity there is to make bugs. So if you have a higher level language that lets you do things with fewer lines of code, with less boilerplate, with less repeated things, with less worrying about details that aren't important to your program, you will produce fewer bugs for the functionality you're making. You're still doing the same number of bugs per lines of code, but because 1,000 lines of Swift does way more than 1,000 lines of assembly, your bug per line is the same, but your bug per functionality is way better. As for Eric's question, is software getting worse? I think basically no. I think it's actually getting better, mostly because every part of the stack that we're using, it gets higher and higher and higher level. And then, of course, we're building on top of everything that has come before. We're getting so much more functionality for the amount of bugs that we're getting. Now, that might not feel important to you because you're like, I don't care that what Twitter client is doing would be science fiction to someone in the 60s in terms of, holy cow, like what is it actually doing under the covers? Networking stacks and requests and data encoding and decoding and the whole operating system stack on top of it and the layout engine. It's like, it is insane what, and then for you, it's like, I scroll, I see a bunch of words and I scroll, right? It's easy for us to take that for granted. But the amount of functionality, as in what is it actually doing to let you use your thumb to scroll a bunch of words, right, is phenomenal. And the number of bugs that it has compared to that amount of functionality versus the number of bugs like a recipe manager on an Apple IIe had, like the number of bugs is similar, but the functionality is vastly greater. So I would say software is getting better, just maybe not in a way that users notice, because users are very quick to take for granted, like, you know, the magic of what these things are doing. And then all we can see is like, yeah, but there are still bugs. There are always going to be bugs unless you can spend huge amounts of time and money stamping them all out, which you can't for an application that lets you scroll tweets or whatever, right? But we do get more and more functionality over time. So that's my take on this question.
Yeah, I think there's also, you have to look at what software is asked to do over time and how that changes over time. Our expectations are so vastly accelerating over time, and what we expect software to do today is so different from what it did back when we, you know, when we had Apple IIs, you know, running PrintShop Pro or whatever. Like, it's so different compared to that. We expect our software to do way more, and that changes a few things. So on one level, John is right that, like, you know, the languages get better, the abstractions we're working on get better, the tools get better, and so that does, it, that multiplies our productivity. Like, how good can a program be with, you know, per programmer working on it, or per hour of time that's put into working on it. We have made huge advances there. But the reason it can feel like software is so buggy these days is that we are asking it to do a heck of a lot more than we ever have before. And that's always increasing. And as soon as software achieves some new amount of functionality, we immediately take it for granted and move on to asking about other things. So, for instance, even if we don't have to go back to the Apple II, I'll just go back to the beginning of the iPhone, because this is like where I've done, you know, a lot of my professional software development. So I've been here a while. I've seen a lot of things change over time, and customer expectations changing over time. And when the iPhone, I'll even say when the App Store first launched, so the iPhone gets the first year for free. When the App Store first launched in 2008, one person could make an app, and the tools were pretty primitive. The hardware was pretty primitive. No, I mean, not compared to the Apple II, by any means. We were way past that. But compared to where we are today, things were simpler and more primitive and lower level. We didn't have luxuries. I mean, heck, the first version of the iPhone SDK didn't even have Interface Builder or Core Data or anything like that. We were super early. You know, everything was Objective-C, manual retain release, auto release, like that kind of stuff.
Oh gosh, that's right.
It was all the UI was built in code for that first. You know, there were no storyboards yet or anything like that. So it was early. It was basic, and you know, UI kit was super early, super basic. But all you had to focus on was whatever that app could do on the iPhone 2.0 screen, and it was a single device with a single screen resolution, and there was no background tasking, there were no extensions, there were no, you know, there was no Apple Watch, there was no iPad, there was no Catalyst app, there was no widgets, like all the stuff that we expect today wasn't there. And back then, you expected also that the app would kind of hold its own data. There was a lot less expectation of cloud-based storage, a lot less expectation of syncing and of cloud backup. Most things didn't use accounts and didn't have, you know, account mechanics in them. There was no in-app purchase. There were very few ads. Like, it was such a different experience back then, not only because of the technological situation, but also because the customer expectations were simpler. Now, today, you are expected, if you're making an iPhone app, you're expected to have all of that stuff. You're expected definitely to have sync. To do sync well, you're probably going to need some kind of basic account system, and that adds a whole bunch of complexity. that's a lot there. You're probably going to have interactions with different web services to pull different stuff in. You're probably going to have, your customers are going to expect you to have things like an iPhone and iPad app that somehow sync. Definitely those have to be the same purchase. You're going to have a watch app probably for certain types of things. You're going to have extensions. You're going to have share extensions. You're going to have a widget somewhere, lock screen widget, main screen widget, watch complication maybe. People expect that now. And so the expectations of what people want you to do are so high that the software necessarily has to be more complicated just to fit what people expect all apps to do these days. And so it can feel like things are worse quality because we're just asking them to do so much more. And there are parts of what we do that are crappy quality. Like, you know, we mentioned Siri earlier, and Siri is really inconsistent. But Siri is so vastly more complex than anything we asked things to do even 15 or 20 years ago. It's frankly amazing it works at all, let alone as, quote, well as it actually does. Like, you know, because Siri actually does work well in certain things sometimes. And it's amazing to know that when you were here in earlier days of technology, like when we didn't have anything close to that. And it's remarkable that it works the way it does even. But the point is, like, the software that we wrote back in the day that might have felt more solid was a lot simpler and in some ways was more solid, but also now we wouldn't be happy with that. And customers demand so much more now that you can't make software like that anymore. And it's a shame because I would love if software was super reliable and super simple in some ways, or rather I think I would love that. But then my actual customer demands would be like, well, I love this really simple software, but could you maybe make an iPad app, or could you maybe like add some, you know, add some shortcut support? Like, there's always something that you want them to add. Like, man, I love paying once for apps and never having to pay again. But, oh, could you add sync to a cloud service? Like, there's so many of those things that modern customer expectations and modern technological environments in which everything has to work and interoperate and meet expectations just can't support that old, simpler way of looking at software.
Oh, you know, so if the lines of the bugs per lines of code was still the same back then, part of the reason, and I think it was, and that is still, you know, a factor, but part of the reason some of those older programs felt more reliable, especially the good ones that we remember, is because the market structure and the incentive structure were different back then, and not back when the iPhone came out, but I'm talking like farther back than that. So before the internet, you had to buy your software in a box on a floppy disk. And if there was something wrong with it, you couldn't just go download an update to that. Because download it where? On CompuServe? Maybe. you know, they'd have a second version on a different floppy disk. So the incentives were for the software developer to spend way more time making sure the software they were going to pay to put on, you know, millions of floppy disks was as bug-free as possible, because they knew they can't just have people install a patch, a day one patch when they launched the app, because there was no internet, right? So those incentives are different, but like, that doesn't mean that the programmers weren't making the exact same number of bugs per lines of code. All that means is they had to spend more time and more money getting that version 1.0 to a more bug-free state. Like any company could do that today. It would just mean they have to ship later, right? That also means if there was a bug, and there certainly was, there was always bugs, it would take way longer for you to get that fixed because you couldn't just download an update. They'd have to print a version 1.1, put that on floppy disk and sometimes sell it to you, or you'd send away for it. And it's just like, it was worse in all sorts of ways that people would not tolerate, right? Whereas now we just expect, oh, there's a bug. There better be an update tomorrow when I wake up, right? Like, it's not, there was not going to be an update to your floppy disk when you woke up, right? It, you know, it was what it was. So those incentives could exist today and do in different markets. For example, in theory, I don't know if this is true. Maybe Casey can tell me. But in theory, military software development has a much slower pace and more thorough QA process. And, yeah, you know, whatever.
Like, so.
Yeah. Well, you know, also more money being spent in various states to be basically a jobs program where we blow people up. Anyway.
Yeah, but it's also a lot higher stakes than, like, you know, some weather app on your phone.
Yeah, or like self-driving. And don't think about it. yeah, that was originally the DARPA challenge. You guys don't remember that. It was a Gnova on it. Anyway.
No, I remember it.
Yeah. So I think like different incentive structures can and do exist, and those also influence perceived quality. But in general, the, you know, human beings produce X number of bugs per Y number of lines of code is not going to change until and unless human beings change. And that happens really slowly. So I think any perception that you have, think about the surrounding context. You know, what functionality am I getting? What incentives exist for this functionality? How fast can I get an update? Because you're trading things off. You're trading off the ability, you know, the ability to ship something with a bug in it is traded off against the ability for that bug to be fixed tomorrow through the magic of software updates, right? And so that creates an incentive structure for shipping software that is different from the one where you know you can't do an update until 6 months from now.
That's really well put. I think you absolutely nailed it. All righty. And then finally for tonight, Thomas Alvarez writes, John mentioned how he wants a Mac Pro with GPUs on cards. And I'm curious what use he has for GPU powered in an ARM-based Mac. If it's gaming, aren't we past that on the Mac now with Apple Silicon and moved on to running Windows on a dedicated gaming PC? We all know how you feel about a dedicated gaming PC, but would you just mind answering the question, please?
Yeah, so I mean, I don't think I've actually talked about my specific needing GPUs on cards for an ARM-based Mac. Mostly, we've been talking about if it doesn't have GPUs on cards, how is it not just a, you know, a Mac Studio with a bunch of empty space or something? So anyway, that setting that thing aside, I am actually interested in significant GPU powered in an ARM-based Mac. Back when we were still entertaining rumors of this sort of quad SoC arrangement, and I did the math on that, that would have enough GPU power to be equivalent to a pretty okay, you know, external PC graphics card, and I would be fine with that. And why do I want that? It's to play games. And you'd be like, well, you can't play any games on an ARM Mac. I still am personally holding out hope that Windows and gaming will get on the ARM bandwagon eventually. I don't have any reason to particularly believe that because it doesn't seem to be really happening, but you know, it seems plausible. Technically, it's certainly possible. We know that. But markets move slowly, and I'm not sure if there's much motion there. Maybe the server stuff needs to go and destroy the economics of good x86 CPUs for that to happen. I don't know how that's all going to happen, but I would like that to happen. And in the meantime, I just, you know, for the same reason I have this big honking Mac that I don't need over here, I just like the idea of having more computing power than I actually need. Even if it's just so I can download like some demo of some 3D program that I'm never going to figure out how to use and just play with or whatever. Or, you know, like I locked myself out of a locked note bag. You know, the Apple Notes, like back before you could use your Apple ID to lock a note, you could put individual passwords on notes. And I had a note that I had put an individual password on that I had forgotten and hadn't put it in Keychain or anything like that.
Whoops.
And so I used my dual GPUs to crack it, like brute force. to brute force crack. Yeah, you can.
That's amazing.
To brute force crack my own password. And guess what? The fans really smile on my Mac Pro. But I did crack because it was a short, like, throwaway password or whatever.
How long did it take?
I don't know, like 5 minutes. Like it wasn't, you know, I did not use a 15 character, whatever password. Like this is an argument for you to do the thing where I don't remember when they did that. It was ages ago where they let you do the thing. Like, do you want to update your thing so your Apple ID and your face can unlock all your notes or whatever? I eventually did that. Right. But, And that's just a silly example, but like I could have also cracked it on, you know, on an iPhone, right? Like I'm not pretending that I need a big GPU to do this, but the same reason that people don't need a sports car because they're not race car drivers, they just like to have one, even though you can't really use it without breaking the law. At least I'm not, you know, breaking the law with my Mac Pro here or whatever. Remember those ads when you couldn't export the G4 to communist countries because it was like a restricted export thing? Yeah. I think Apple had an ad campaign about that.
Classified as ammunition because it's too good of a computer.
Yeah. Anyway, I just want it. Even if it's for that, you know, so I can play a five-year-old port, a port of a five-year-old game in high frame rates, the macOS version or whatever. That's it. It's, you know, and it's for games. Like, I really hope someday we'll, you know, because ARM-based SoCs made by Apple with lots of GPU power, that's really good hardware for games. Too bad no one makes games for it. Too bad Windows doesn't run it. Like, I get it. Doesn't make perfect sense. And as for the dedicated gaming PC, honestly, if I had a different house with another desk for things to put on, I probably would have bought a gaming PC by this point. But I don't.
No.
I mean, maybe. It's easy for me to say that,
the
knowing that I don't have that.
The desk is holding you back?
Yeah, right?
Yeah, well, I don't. Well, so my
I'm
hatred
buy
of Windows.
An entire Mac Pro instead of a desk.
Well, I mean, no, it's not the desk. It's the house where the desk would go. Like, there's no there's no place. It's not like I'm getting a new house anytime soon. And I do have my, I've talked to those about, I do have my own irrational personal biases against Microsoft and Windows that will make me never want to buy a PC. And honestly, at this point, it's been such a long streak. I feel like I need to keep it going. But in theory, if, you know, I also haven't bought an Xbox for that same stupid reason. But in theory, if I had a bigger house with another desk for me to put stuff on, I might actually get a gaming PC to play PC games. And that's why I'm enjoying my Mac Pro. I can play Microsoft Flight Simulator with like my fancy new GPU, and it looks really cool, and I can't play it on any other platform. I play it in Windows, and I get good frame rate, and it looks really nice. And someday soon, someday that will be over because I'll have an ARM-based Mac Pro. But hopefully by then, like, Microsoft will like port Flight Simulator to Windows on ARM, and I'll be able to somehow boot into Windows on ARM from an ARM-based Mac Pro and play Flight Simulator at even higher frame rates. That is the future I believe in, that I'm dreaming of, and that's why I want my ARM-based computer to have a beefy GPU.
You might have to keep dreaming on that one.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Thanks to our sponsor this week, Collide, and thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. Thank you so much. We will talk to you next week.
All right. So speaking of sponsorships and memberships and things of that nature, we are trying to come up with, like we were talking about the pre-show, more ideas for member specials. And it would be really awesome if we could get some ideas from listeners. And so it would be excellent if you used Mastodon, if possible, to toot at, and I'll take the fall on this. You can toot at me or the ATP show account, but you can send it my way. In particular,
what is the ATP show account, Casey?
Good question.
I believe it's at ATPFM at mastodon.social.
Thank you.
Yeah, how does Mike do this on Upgrade? He does it. He has a really good way of handling it. It's on mastodon.social at ATPFM, which is
You don't need to overcomplicate it. Most Mastodon clients and the websites, the search is good enough that if you just type ATPFM into your search box on any Mastodon instance, it will probably find us. They should do a better job. I was thinking about this, that clients should do a better job of indicating the verified URL. You know how we talked about before, like
put it like as like a little subtitle in the search.
Yeah,
results,
like
name,
with the green check mark
URL.
Yeah, because what you want to know if there's like 15 ATPFM accounts that like impersonate, which one is the real one? Only one of them can possibly be verified against ATP.fm, the website, and clients know that and show it. They show it in search because it would help people find things. But anyway,
that's a good idea.
That's the address. We'll put a link in the show notes. You can also go to ATP.fm/feedback.
Yes, but that sends email. Nobody likes email.
Oh, email's fine.
Ugh. Anyway, so if you have ideas for members episodes so here's the criteria. Like, we'll accept any ideas, but generally speaking, what we're trying to figure out is something that we are equipped to handle. So as an example, I would love to play Destiny one time with John and Marco. I don't have any PlayStation in the house. I don't have any video capture software in the house. I don't think any of the three of us, except maybe John, has the patience to put together a video or do
anything.
Oh,
I totally have the
patience
for it. And like I said, PlayStation 5 has video capture built in. We're very close, people. Marco's got a PS5. I've got a PS5. Casey's the holdout. But anyway, that's already on the list. You don't have to suggest that one.
Well, I'm just saying that, like, something along those lines that requires hundreds of dollars of investment.
And, or us going on a road trip across Australia, probably not going to happen. Cool idea, but, you know.
No, great idea, but not going to happen. So things that we can handle with just a microphone, and we can spend some amount of money. In fact, if I can convince the boys, I think I have a pretty decent idea for one that involves spending an absurd amount of money for a little bit of food. And I mean those words, I choose those words very carefully. but anyway, something that we can handle, and one thing in particular that we've been wrestling with, particularly John, is we think, how did you phrase this when we were talking privately? We think we can get a pretty good licensing agreement, I think John had said, for top four. And so what is a good top four? Well, top four Apple products, sure, that's kind of obvious, but there's got to be something more creative. Top four, we were talking about doing privately, we were talking about top four Apple announcements, but then we have to do like 35 hours of research remembering all these announcements. So,
or do we? Haven't you listened to top four?
Yeah, fair.
Yeah.
So anyway, the point is, it particularly in the vicinity of top four, but even in general, if you have a member idea, please, you know, send us a toot on Mastodon or feedback if you must. I guess our feedbacks are much better than Apple's, aren't they? But anyway, yeah, send it our way. We would love to hear it. And we hope to, again, this is not a guarantee, but our kind of, our goal, which we may not always achieve, is maybe one of these a month if we can. It'll probably won't be every month. It may be every other. But our goal, our hope, is about one a month. So, and we can keep watching movies, and I'm sure we will. But let's try to figure out as a collective. Let's figure out some other fun stuff to do. And if enough of you do join, then yes, I will buy a stupid PlayStation, and I will play stupid Destiny with my stupid friends.
And your kids will thank you for it. And by the way, for people who know, Top 4 is a podcast that Marco does with his wife, Tiff. It is on Relay. We'll put a link in the show notes. I don't want to try to explain it. They ostensibly list the top four of something. It's an experience.
It is an experience for sure.
It will make you mad, guaranteed.
Can confirm.
And I have to say, I have a newfound respect for what they do in that program, having done just one very easy food-based challenge on a podcast, and I cannot fathom what these two champions have done to their bodies over the course of this show.
Very, very true.
It is like I have a visceral reaction now to thinking about what they're going through. And that's also why I'm not really gung-ho about new food-based challenges in ATP, but, you know, I may be forced to do some. Semi-related to membership, which Casey also skipped over because I wanted to put before this, I'm going to take advantage of my podcast platform to say I'm trying to sell my old cameras and no one seems to want to buy them. So I'm going to put a link in the show notes to a webpage I put up for me selling my old cameras. I'm being silly and for now trying to sell them to people who are willing to meet up in the Boston metro area to avoid shipping fees and stuff like that. That's probably not going to work, and it's probably going to fall through. I'm going to have to ship these two. But for now, if you live in the Boston metro area and want to buy any of my stuff that's listed on this webpage, it's going to be in the show notes. It's just my old Sony A6300 and a couple lenses for what I think are pretty reasonable prices, and everything's in nice condition. You know, hit me up. All the information is on the webpage that will be in the show notes, or you can just go to, I'm going to read a URL now, hypercritical.co/4-sale/camera. Anyway, go to the show notes. And I'm not going to say this is directly related to the bad sponsorships, but it's not related.
It's so true. All right, anything else?
I think that's it.
Okay. Oh, God, it's 2.5 hours already.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Time flies. Time flies.
Radar, man. Radar.
I have so many more things I could say about it.
Now. I know. We were trying to be short. That's us trying to be short.
I know. That's the sad thing. All right, where am I going here? Maybe I'm Dead is excellent.
Threaded rod follow up.
Say it again.
Threaded rod follow up.
Yeah. And the carbon rod.
I actually like. I did not have any nuts. I know it's a little bit toward double entendre.
No, I was proud of you for not snickering during that part, Casey. Mm-hmm.
I tried very hard.
Yeah, that's also true. That is 100% true.
It's true though.
Yeah. All right, well, what else do you guys like? I still like Maybe I'm Dead, but I can entertain other ideas.
I like that.
It's a little morbid. Let me see what else.
It is a little morbid.
Hey, Buggy Fast was also good. Threaded Rod follow-up is good. Let's see.
By the way, it's not fixed. By the way, that bug for the bootleg people.
The long poll, that's good.
In my applications, they have a checkbox that says launch this on login. And there's two different APIs. I talked about this in the show. There's two different APIs to do it. My applications, when you check that box, they still show up in the login items thing in the section that says like allow in the background. And my app doesn't run in the background. It just gets, you know, it gets smeared with the paintbrush of running in the background. And they're like, oh, that's a bug. It shouldn't be showing up there. It should only show up in the top part where it says these apps will launch on login. And it shouldn't show up in the allow in the background. Maybe it's because you had an old version of the app. Maybe it's because you just blah, blah, blah. Well, anyway, the bug was, oh, we think that's fixed now. I'm running 13.3. My apps are still in the allow in the background section. So not fixed. But it's an annoying bug. I understand the confusion about it. There's no way, you know, given the carrier pigeon bandwidth between and the weeks between communications and how terrible those communications are, there's no way this is ever going to be resolved. It's like, Apple, you just got to figure this out yourself. Are they supposed to be in that section? Are they not supposed to be? Like, you know, whatever. Like, none of my users complain about it, so I no longer care, but fix your stuff.
Yeah.
Please and thank you. I still like Maybe I'm Dead. What was the long pole? Was that actually about the threaded rod, or was that?
No, that was... John said it about, it was like a long-term request. Was it for Siri? I forget.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember.
And that is good.
Not Chris Spinazzo. What the heck was the long poll about?
Yeah, I don't remember.
AI inbreeding. $6 hacksaw blade.
I do love, although I can understand why we wouldn't use it, reverse poop emoji sandwich. Which I suggested, but and you said, John,
it's like what was that KFC one with the chicken was the bread?
Oh yeah, I know exactly what you're thinking. Double down? Surprisingly, I did not ever try that. I know you're proud of me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to do a poop emoji thing.
No,
that's fair.
That'll just break everyone's RSS feeds.
Yeah.
All right. So, what are we thinking then?
My favorite slap in the face. What was that one?
When you get asked to reply and you don't reply fast enough on radar.
Chris can't remember what his suggested title was.
Well done. Actually, my favorite slap in the face is pretty good, even though it's spelled incorrectly. I can get behind that one.
Yeah, it's not bad.
So what are your top two?
Maybe I'm dead and my favorite slap in the face. Apparently a very morbid night for me tonight.
Yeah, I like my favorite slap in the face, even though I don't even remember precisely what that's about. I like it
it's
better
the,
than
when
the
your
one.
Radar. It's about your radar, man.
Did I say it?
Yes, I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure.
Anyway, I very often pick titles so that I've said this before, so that when I look at the title in the future, I'll be able to say, oh, that's the episode where we complained about radar. And I feel like this will do that.
Well, if it's involving a slap in the face, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm good with that. Otherwise, I'd go with dead or long pole.
Yeah, let's just spell favorite, right?
Yeah.
I did. Don't you worry. Don't you worry. All right, where is the... John, why do you do this with the disabled button? I don't know where I have...
It's like, you know why I do it, to stop you from hitting submit. It's working as designed. You have an error, or maybe it's a bug in the compiler.
Yeah, I did. We moved on.
I mean, considering the code that is disabling that button, I wrote and submitted without ever running it. I don't know, see how there could ever be a bug in it.
Oh, mother fuckers.
Because I can't run Margo's stupid server locally because he doesn't have a Docker container. So I'm just like, well, I can syntax check this JavaScript. Anyway,
it's a PHP app that there's like 15 files. Like, it's so easy.
Well, you could give me instructions on how to run it locally. You're like, oh, there's no good way to run it locally.
That's not. No, you just need PHP, which your Mac, I think, still comes with.
All right, sure. I'm just saying, like, there should be a little README file that says, hey, if you want to run this locally, do this, this, and this. And I would have done this. I'm willing to do all sorts of steps, but there was nothing. So I wasn't going to just figure it out. So I'm like, I just write this. It'll probably work.
No, so step one is, like, learn how to host PHP on your computer. And then step two is host the site. That's it.
No, that's not hilarious to it. It's like,
how hard could it be?
Yeah, I'm going to give you an empty Mac and say, start with your GitHub repo and get it up and running. And you'll be like, oh, it's a surprising number of steps.
Wait, did I screw this up? No. Why do I not see what I miss? Oh, I'm blind. I'm sorry. Never mind. Carry on, everyone. Carry on. I thought I thought 527 was missing, but it's not. I'm an idiot.
I mean, the pitch to the bootleg people. One of these lenses is way underpriced. You should totally take advantage of me. Actual retail price, $800. I'm selling
$1. $1.
I'm selling it for $300 today. Like if you buy it today new, it's still $800. I don't know why it's still $800, but it is. I looked it up. The prices here are all using the Marco method, which is I search completed sales on eBay and then I undercut them by like $50.
It's like if I want a quick sale, I basically will underprice it by completed items by like 20%. And that way, and I know it'll just sell quickly.
I don't do 20%, but I am doing things like, including an extra battery and an SD card with the camera. And, you know, those batteries are like, you know, $70-$80 for the stupid Sony cameras.
Well, the 20% thing is, it's partly because, like, if you sell something on eBay, you're going to lose, like, 15% in just all the fees and everything.
Yeah, that's why I want to find people local for these, because once you pay for shipping, it cuts into the deal. Like, these aren't that expensive items, so $20 in shipping is a significant portion of the price. And so it's so much better deal if you can just, you know, meet me in a parking lot and do the exchange. But then I'm limiting the people who want to buy this to people in the Boston metro area. And I say metro area because I'm willing to drive. I drove my receiver out to, you know, like a half an hour away down south for someone who came up from Rhode Island. And, you know, like, well, we'll get the deal done. Just come buy my cameras.
Make me an offer. Make me an offer.
Eventually, if I can't find any locally, I'll do shipping. I just don't know how much it's going to cost to ship. They're smallish. And I have all the original boxes, so I should be able to, you know, ship it for, I don't know, a two-digit price. Shipping's so expensive. I ship a bunch of Lego to my nephews. Hopefully, they're not listening to the bootleg. And those boxes are big, and shipping big boxes costs so much money.
Yeah.
Too much money. I was like, should we have just rebought the Legos and had them shipped to them? of course, Lego is also super expensive, so it actually wasn't cheaper, but it made me think about it.
So what'll it take to get you in this camera tonight?
We're re-gifting Legos that we bought for our children that they never even opened because they have too
many.
Yeah,
I got one of those.
Yeah. Like literally unopened, brand new.
Yeah, I think we have one or two of those in closets in various places.
Mm-hmm.
All right, anything else for the bootlegging live people?
I believe that's it, I guess. Yeah. All right. So thanks, live people, for listening.
And truly, bootleg people, I'm telling you, we keep whining about the ad stuff because it's real bad. So bootleg people.
Thank you for being members.
Genuinely. Yeah. Thank you so much. It really. I know I'm being snarky, or I sound like I'm being snarky, but really and truly, having this membership stuff has taken my stress level down 1,000,000,000% because I would be really freaking scared right now if it wasn't for membership. So I know I like to try to say it a lot, but maybe even too much, but truly, 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 it means the world to the three of us that you've paid a few bucks to listen to this. It really, really helps. So thank you so much.
Yeah. And get in quick before Johnny writes the whole CMS and Pearl.
Don't worry about that. That's not going to happen.
Bye,
I did redo my own website. I upgraded everything and made new Docker containers with the new latest version of Perl and all sorts of other fancy stuff. So,
oh, look at you go.
Which was like, and what is the result of that? Absolutely nothing. No change, no visible change to the website.
That is success defined.
Yep. Mm-hmm. All right. Bye, live people. Bye.